Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 21. And this evening, we're going to discuss December 8th through the 13th, 1988. And before we get going with the show, let me do the introductions. And as we have our co-host every week on this show, also co-host of the 605 Super Podcast, which I'm sure he'll talk about later on, David Biggs of Span Biggs. How's it going?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty good. And we have a distinguished guest this evening.
Yes.
As this is someone that's been around the business for
ever,
quite a long time. Probably longer than he'll admit to. But he's done everything in the business. Take pictures. Set up rings. Wrestled. Promoted.
Was in one of everyone's favorite angles.
I was going to bring that up last. Book, and as president of the Wrestling Fans International Association in 1984, was part of one of the most legendary angles in the history of Memphis wrestling when Eddie Gilbert and Tommy Rich broke up the New Fabulous Ones. And he was on an earlier segment, which led up to the whole deal to begin with. But yeah, we have the man behind the WFIA, Pete Lederberg. Pete, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I guess distinguished is a nice way than saying being old, right?
Well, God, I mean, when did you become a fan? When was it, like, the first shows you went to?
Well, the first shows I went to was back in 1976 in Florida, and my background was that I lived in New York before that, and I caught a little bit on TV late night, like a lot of people did, on that midnight WOR show. And first memory, I think, was Chief J. Strongbow, of all things. They had a little segment where he explained why people kicked out on the count of two.
Oh, wow.
I remember it being, you know, you didn't want to kick out on one because sometimes you need to rest a little bit. And I moved down to Florida, and needless to say, action was a little tighter and put it mildly, and faster and stuff like that. And I was hooked, and that's when I started going.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. And later on, you know, when we get to the plug section, I definitely want to talk about WFIA, because that's something that a lot of this generation really don't know about. But that was a big deal, you know, in about 30, 35 years ago. So we'll hit in on that later. But let's get to the show, as we are going to start in the National Wrestling Alliance. And we have a big debut this week, although not of a wrestler, as Jim Herd made his debut at the World Championship Wrestling tapings on December 8th at Techwood Studios to meet with everyone, as his official start date isn't until January the 3rd. Now, Herd has put it out already that he wants the wrestlers doing clean jobs as well as more pinfall finishes, along with better post-production on the TV shows with a crew of new faces. And Dave Meltzer thinks that Jim Crockett will be the head booker as the transition takes place, and that Dusty Rhodes' days are definitely numbered. Dusty completely no-showed the Techwood tapings on that day. Broken toe. The current booker structure is Crockett, Kevin Sullivan, Barry Windham, and J.J. Dillon. Now, Crockett's booking moves are already being questioned by the higher-ups, as his proposed main event for the February clash of the Road Warriors and Tenryu versus Ron Simmons, Steve Casey, an Italian Stallion, was deemed unacceptable, quote-unquote, by the higher ups at Turner. Now, Bix, we talked about some of this on the Death of Crockett show. This is about the time period where we ended it. This is the beginning of the Herd era we're about to go into. What do you think about the early reports of how Herb was going to try to change the product?
It seems like a good idea. I mean, until you find out that the guy actually didn't know anything about wrestling and possibly may have fabricated the most important part of his resume.
Yeah. Which we found out later on, you know, way later on. Yeah. The fact that he was, said he was the director of the Wrestling at the Chase, TV shows in St. Louis and stuff like that. And yeah, it wasn't things. I mean, he was part of it, but you know, his experience wasn't as vast as he had led on to Jack Petrick and the boys.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way, because Jack Petrick was his friend, and who knows exactly what was going on there. He had been friends with Jack Petrick for decades.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I think at that point they probably haven't said, you know, we've heard enough yet, you know. Maybe they should have when they did the interview.
Now, Jimmy Crockett, you know, the guy just went out of business, but he's still there as the booker. And Pete,
well,
you know,
he's more than just the booker. At this point, he's still in charge of the company.
Yeah, he's still in charge of the company during the transition. But, you know, and you before the show, you asked if that Clash match was a joke. No, it was not a joke, although that Clash would eventually be a joke under different people. But
and it ended up pissing off Abba anyway.
Yeah, but Jimmy Crockett, I mean, the Clash show the day before was the show he booked. And I just watched that show today, and it was a really strong show in the ring, but still you had a match like Dr. Death versus Italian Stallion go over 15 minutes on a Clash. And it's like, what are you doing? You know? So yeah, Jimmy Crockett's booking prowess is definitely being questioned.
Well, you know, I think when you look at how he had the Italian Stallion booked in the main event, you know, against Road Warriors and Tenryu, I guess going 15 with Dr. Death wasn't such a bad idea to him. I don't know. And, you know, the other thing I noticed on this is maybe, I don't know if it occurred to you guys, but maybe Dusty didn't really say anything like that. They just said something, and Dusty said, "Baby, the last movie I saw was Krakatoa, East of Java." And they thought maybe he said he broke his toe. So who knows?
Yeah, the last that you saw Dusty was on that Clash, and they did a deal where he was late, quote unquote, for his match with Road Warrior Animal. Then eventually shows up. Match length goes 3 minutes, and behind the scenes, that was the day that he was pretty much removed from power as the booker. And there was a lot of stuff going on. Of course, he stayed and worked Starrcade and all that stuff, but I mean, he was already on the outs big time, and lots of rumors are going around about Dusty. In fact, one of them was, you know, making this way around like the Torch and stuff like that, was that Dusty and Bill Watts were going to hook up and reform a new version of Mid-South Wrestling. And could you just, I mean, Pete, imagine if going in 1989, Dusty and Bill Watts getting together and doing business, you know?
Yeah, that, you know, it goes back to the old days in Florida again. Those guys, do you really think it would have worked with the way their egos were at that point? I know I've listened to Watts a lot, and I've seen that he said he could keep Dusty under control. It's one of the first things that he said. I believe when they brought him in to be Booker, I think it was for WCW, actually.
Yeah, and he did.
And he did. So maybe it could have worked.
Yeah, but the thing is, where do you get talent? You know, you got your people already lined up with Crockett. You got your people with WWF. There's not a whole lot of big names that's sitting around. And when Dusty formed, you know, the new, like, the FCW or PWF in Florida after he was gone, I mean, he didn't have a whole lot of big names to work with, like Dick Slater and guys like that. But yeah.
Yeah, it was the same. Yeah, and they really did it essentially with the guys that had been around Florida quite a bit, with a lot of young guys.
Yeah, so any startup would have been tough. And we saw a lot of people try, you know, in the years after. And, you know, of course, they all failed in the end.
Well, I mean, if it was on a major scale, though, I guess he could have tried to bring in guys, you know, hire away from Jarrett's two promotions or from other places. But, I mean, it's not like there was a great amount of guys to try to build a major company around that were not in the two major companies.
Exactly.
But, you know, I don't know what the contracts were like back then. And those guys had needless to say, tons of connections and tons of guys that love working with them. And I don't know, I'm not talking about personality wise necessarily, but, you know, guys that would have dropped anything to work with them. I mean, I'm not speaking for Cornette or anything, but I know that he loved working with Watts, you know.
Well, and their contract ran out, you know, in early 89.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So they definitely would have been up there in the mix. I guess the Fantastics, you know, would have probably been around. Gordy, maybe, you know.
Well, the Fantastics were leaving, too. So, yeah, I mean, they...
Yeah. Yeah, so there's, you know, it's sort of like a UWF rewind in a lot of ways. And, heck, you could have the last stampede with Dusty and Watts against Midnight.
Yeah. And Landell was around, you know, working different places. I mean, there's guys.
It would probably be more guys who were in Japan. Like, I'm trying to think, like, you know, who knows? Like, maybe someone like Spivey would have jumped or something.
They could have got Hansen.
Yeah, between tours. But it probably would have just ended up being like the UWF, where you keep having to book around everyone leaving for Japan.
Exactly.
Yeah, I never heard that before, but that... It's kind of interesting if you think about it.
Yes, one of those what ifs, you know, if it ever happened. Now, back to Crockett, back to NWA, no longer Crockett. The closest that anyone in Greensboro can go see Starrcade on pay-per-view is in Durham, North Carolina, as the local cable companies aren't carrying the show and there are no more closed circuit showings. Now, Rogers Cablevision isn't carrying the show because there's a dispute over whether or not fans will order the show, then default payment of the bill because of all the wrestling of pay-per-view and their Christmas bills.
Wow.
Dave said that he is told this isn't enough homes to be disastrous, but it is significant.
So it's like 900 lines, I guess. But this, I don't remember ever hearing about this ever. So, I mean, these are people that are already paying their bills, though. I mean, this is not... I mean, I guess you can say the same thing about the phone bill, but we're talking about a big difference in scale here.
I guess it's the opinion of wrestling fans when you think, Pete, that all these wrestling fans, they don't have money. So
yeah, well...
No default.
Yeah, same reason that they're still having trouble getting advertisers, I guess.
Yeah.
The old wrestling fan stigma.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking that, too, but it sounds like... they were saying, or at least Dave was saying, from the way, you know, Chris wrote it up in our notes, at least, that it had already happened on other shows. I mean, that's so what it seems like.
There must have been some type of experience happening.
But it's local. Well, it's fascinating too that it's in Greensboro that this is happening.
Yes, like the whole Starrcade.
Yeah, that you would think of all the cities that this would happen in, it would not be Greensboro, North Carolina.
And Beverly mentioned Charlotte was having issues too. He never really went in depth, but, you know, supposedly Charlotte was having problems with their companies. So, yeah, it's crazy. You know, Crockett home ground, they can't even watch the big pay-per-view of the year.
Do you guys remember what pay-per-views cost back then?
I think Crockett pay-per-views in early WCW were like 15, right?
It could be. I'm just trying to think how much money we're talking about.
I would think no more than 20, which is funny because, you know, when they came in on VHS, they were double.
But I think it was WWF were $19.95 and WCW were $14.95 in the early days.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I was just using it for a reference point,
right, of course,
how much money are they going to be out, you know? But unless they thought some way they were going to do something where they're just going to order Vince's pay-per-views and just try to screw them and not pay on those. Who knows?
Yeah, and this is a different era when pay-per-views weren't as common. So you had Survivor Series in November, and you got Starrcade in December, and then you got the Rumble in January, which is the first time that's on pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of pay-per-views going on, but that's three months. So...
And, you know, who knows? It could have been just, I mean, I'm using the wrong thing here, but it could have been a program director. You know, it could have been one guy thinking this. You know, the companies weren't as big. Who knows how many people were in on that decision?
It could have been sabotage, too. You know, we'll talk about later on. WWF putting their hands into another show. So that could have been part of it, too. Now, there's considerable belief that Ricky Steamboat will be coming in soon because Dusty is not in power anymore. And there's already been plans made between Steamer and the Bookers. And Pete, of course, this is definitely coming true. Yeah. He was at TV tapings not too long after this to make his big return. And yeah, the big deal with Dusty, you know, the story was, you know, there's that big time heat there between the two over what happened in 1985 when Steamboat felt like he was, you know, being buried because of Magnum coming in. So, yeah.
Well, that there's a long history of that in Florida, you know, where it's, you know, talk how much there is to it. There's where smoke, there's probably fire, where, you know, you hear things about a guy like Steve Kern, for instance, getting over huge. And then all of a sudden, the rug didn't get pulled out from under him, but it was talked about a lot that Dusty would hold people down, and you could get popular, but not too popular. And that's been going on down in Florida for many years. So, you know, that's another piece to it. You know, he had that reputation, and he already had the heat with Steamer, so could be.
Now, you know, I was wondering, though, like, how much of the heat between the two of them, was it actually, like, did something specific happen, or was it just Steamboat deciding, hey, I'm going to leave because he's pushing Magnum and I'm not going to be the number two or number one baby face anymore, so I should leave. Like, did any actual event happen between the two of them?
I never heard of any actual event. And the thing was, if you watch the television, I mean, Steamer wasn't really buried. I mean, he was with Knoedl feuding with the Koloss at that time. And then he just up and quit and went to, you know, work for WWF like 2 weeks later.
Yeah, I mean, the last appearances of him and Crockett that I've seen, he's still in like TV main events and stuff. And like,
yeah, he's in the main in the scene. He's not in the main angles, but he's in the scene.
And he was being booked as main event in main events on house shows too. Like the the Philly debut was him against Flair in '85. Yeah.
You know, maybe Steamboat's such a nice guy that he gets a pass on all this. Maybe it's just that Vince came in with a better offer. I mean, I'm going with what you guys are saying here, because the other thing is, though, that Dusty did have that reputation where those other guys I was mentioning, they were kept strong. But there's a big difference between being kept strong and being on top. And,
you know, another guy that I you may remember this, Pete, that I think suffered through that was Bugsy McGraw.
Yeah, and even I don't want to say Jack Briscoe, but it was very strange how he won the title. I know he wanted time off. I mean, that was obvious. But then later on, you would just see that guys would go just so much, and then, you know, Jack would come in and out. He'd stop. He would disappear. You know, and it wasn't like he was going anywhere else. And they had the guys that more or less homesteaded. You know, the Briscoes, Kern and Graham, those guys. But once a guy just, and like you said, Bugsy was over gigantic for a while. I'm sure you guys saw that. Like would turn babyface, right?
Oh yeah, totally.
And I mean, it's been talked about forever down here. That's all I can tell you, that ever since Dusty got big, that's exactly it. They get just so big, and then, you know, but they would be kept strong because they still need the support, the undercard. And, you know, back then, Dusty could work. You know, like a lot of people just saw him barely moving and stuff like that. But they needed guys to hold things up, and he'd go touring nationally, so miss some big shows or, you know, shows, let's put it that way. Maybe not big ones, but remember, they were running weekly everywhere. So you needed guys to be on top and needed guys that were over to draw when he wasn't here. So it's a really strange dichotomy there.
Yeah, exactly. And Bix mentioned Philadelphia, and the company was having some serious problems on the road. And on December the 10th, they drew the lowest crowd in Philadelphia in many decades of 1,626 fans, with the lowest gate ever, $22,812.
Ooh.
And this is the Civic Center, and this is the card. And so you kind of could see why maybe this was the case. So you had Russian Assassin 1, the Angel of Death, defeating our Italian Stallion. We had the Fantastics, Rodgers and Fulton going over Jonathan Holliday and Rip Morgan.
I got to interrupt for a second. So was Jonathan Holliday in the territory? Because I would say he, I'd think maybe he was replacing someone, but I don't think he was a Philly guy.
He was working shots. He was on a tryout basis. And he was doing like an effeminate gimmick. You know, he was a guy that mainly worked in Portland.
And Calgary. Do you know the story about his, or at least his version, or the different versions of how he left Calgary?
No. Yeah, I saw some of that.
Oh, on Kayfabe Memories, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's like, I guess, Buddy Wayne, not the Memphis Buddy Wayne, the Northwest Buddy Wayne, Steve Finley, had written about that that Jonathan Holliday, I guess, had kind of stooged off to, I guess, Emile Dupree? When he found out that both Stampede and the Vancouver office were closing. So it screwed with how much money everyone was going to make. Because he just told him for some reason that they were closing when he tried to get work. So what was it, the Design of My Kid beat him up?
Yeah, I think so.
And he wrote a long screed challenging that. I don't remember what exactly, if he said Dynamite Kid sneak attacked him or something, but he seemed very high on his own skills in an interesting way, but whatever. I felt like people, if I didn't give any context to who Jonathan Holliday was, people would be wondering why I was asking about Jonathan Holliday, but anyway.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy. Back to the show, we had the original Midnight Express, Condrey and Rose, going over the Texas Broncos, Dustin Rose and Kendall Windham. We have Ivan Koloff going over Russian Assassin 2, which was Jack Victory. Then we have Barry Windham defending his U.S. title of Eddie Gilbert and retaining. We have Dusty Rhodes and Rick Steiner going over Kevin Sullivan, who's subbing from Captain Mike Rotundo and Dr. Death. And your main event's an elimination match between Luger and Sting as the Road Warriors.
Now, did they just go over completely clean, two pins?
It just said the results I had just had them winning. So
I can't imagine. They probably got FDQ in there somewhere.
Somewhere, definitely. Something's going on. Now, also at this show, it was announced that the Junkyard Doll will be coming in for the next show, and the crowd booed.
I have a well, because that's interesting too. Because first of all, I thought George Scott was who brought JYD in.
No, JYD was at the Clash.
That's right.
He replaced Nikita Koloff when Nikita
that's right.
quit.
Okay, so I'm almost wondering if, I guess if it wasn't Jim Herd, then I wonder if they heard these Watts Dusty rumors and decided just in case in JYD, so Watts can't hire him.
Yeah, it's a smart play if that was the truth. Even though JYD was in a bad state at this time period, but yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Never put that together. Wow, you know, I'm going to have to listen to you guys a little more. I'm learning something here.
Awesome. Hey, there's a lot of these shows in the archives, so go check them out. Now, on December 11th in Richmond, which we talked about that on this show before, that town, they had drew the lowest crowd in recorded history of 425 fans. Now, Bix, when we did the show with Brian last, you know, a couple weeks ago, about 1985, they were drawing 8,000 people in the Coliseum. And now they're down to 425.
I mean,
in 3 years.
And that's one of their major towns. I mean, even if they weren't running it as often because of what we talked about a couple weeks ago, that's really, really, really bad.
It shows you how the territory, you know, they burnt out their major cities. And this is a perfect example. Now, the show proper, Midnights over Broncos, the original Midnights, Fantastics over Mark Fleming and Rip Morgan, Ivan Koloff over Russian Assassin 2, Bam Bam Bigelow over Russian Assassin 1, Rotundo and Doc over Eddie Gill and Rick Steiner, and your main event, Dusty, Luger, and Sting over the Road Warriors and Barry Windham, well, Battle to Double Disqualification.
That's a better card. Yeah, that's a better card.
That's a better main event, but 425 fans.
Wow.
Yeesh.
It almost looks like, it almost looks like a TV taping. I mean, seriously, and, you know, maybe besides them screwing up the territory, it could be the beginning of a little bit of burnout, too. You know, you're seeing so much on TV and whatnot, but that really does look like a TV taping.
Yeah, they burnt out all the old Crockett cities. It was pretty bad at this point. They couldn't draw in none of them. I mean, it was terrible. Yeah, they did it in a good year and a half. Just killed the whole loop.
As far as the overexposure, though, I do think Pete could have a point because, and this is also, I wonder if at the time, if the addition of WCW Main Event on TBS could have hurt house shows a little bit. Because that was a big increase in the consistent quality of TV matches.
At the time, yes.
Yeah.
Because and they were actually showing some main matches. But, you know, I don't know.
I also think it needs to be pointed out that, you know, I'm just looking at this, that the Italian Stallion was not on this show. But he was
no, he
on
was
the
not.
10th and the 8th. And, you know, he brings his people, and then Morgan teamed with Mark Fleming instead of Jonathan Holliday as well.
Yeah, Mark Fleming's a local guy. You know, yeah, he was a guy from the area. So, yeah, that's interesting. And Bam Bam Bigelow was on the 11th show too.
And of course, Mark Fleming became the head trainer of the Luthez Academy of Wrestling.
That's right. Worked at WWFI as well in the 90s.
Wow.
Now, speaking of Bam Bam Bigelow, and he'll be part of this little section, as no one knows where Al Perez has been since he has no-showed all of his bookies for the past week. Everyone assumes he is gone, but he does return on January the 1st. Now, also, lots of uneasiness regarding Bam Bam Bigelow, as he has been no-showing lots of dates as well. And there's a contingency plan in place for putting Eddie Gilbert in his slot at Starrcade against Barry Windham.
Huh.
Which probably would have been a better match. But yeah, we just saw Bam Bam at the Richmond show, but he worked. He when I looked at his schedule, he worked a show on the 6th, the 11th, and then didn't work again until Starrcade. So yeah, that's kind of interesting there. But yeah, Biggs, this is the era where Bam Bam Bigelow was like one of these guys that was. You know, he had just left WWF. He was in this, you know, territory. You know, had a buzz about him, but would eventually leave out of there, and then became like this big name free agent for years until he finally got, you know, back in a major company in 1990. Although he didn't stay long there, he was just a guy that was just in and out of everywhere in this time period.
Yeah, I'm curious what exactly was going on here, if it was money or whatever, but, I really wish he could have done more during this run, because that Wyndham match is so good, you know, and the tag matches they had on TV with, who was it, Wyndham and Flair against Bam Bam and Dusty?
It sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they had some really, he had some really good stuff while he was there, would have been interesting, because he was still in his physical prime at this point. So I would have been curious to see him do, do more there with those kind of workers. I mean, it's weird because he has such a weird career arc. I mean, yeah, we've talked about him a bunch because of how he keeps coming up on these shows, although he hasn't for a few weeks. But it's like, in a way, like, even though he's a better worker, absolutely, as he got more experience, but he had his best matches as a rookie, which is very strange. You know what I mean?
He peaked early.
Like that.
Yeah, it's a great point.
He peaked early in the ring, no doubt. And, as he went along, I don't know what happened, but he was good in Japan. We got to give him credit on that. When he had some good matches in New Japan, but... Yeah, totally. His best work was Memphis, you know, more often than not. You know,
well, maybe that whole, that whole Russian stuff with the Crusher Yurkov stuff got in his head and, you know, just very confused young man. I don't know.
Well, he went back to Memphis after that and teamed with Lawler against Violent Rich and had great matches. So, yep. And maybe he got it out of it there. Now, yeah. Eddie Gilbert's name has come up. And Pete, you went way back with Eddie Gilbert. I mean, this is the biggest run of his career. And so, he is being pushed up at the level with Flair and Wyndham. I mean, what did you think about the time seeing your old buddy, you know, being spotlighted in this big role on national television?
Well, he came in, and I remember he brought Steamboat in as that mystery partner.
Yeah.
In a tag match and whatnot. And I was just real happy for him. But at the time, if you think about it, he's a baby face, and Eddie was best as a heel. You know, I think it was a little late for him to be having a pretty boy baby face run, if that makes any sense. And I thought he was much better as a heel at that time. But I was so happy for him because he's one of the best, best people down to earth and a huge wrestling fan. Like, that was the thing. I know almost everybody knows that about him, but a lot of people say he didn't change, but the people he knew well will tell you he didn't change at all. He, you know, some people say change, he got a big head. He never did. And it was just the same no matter what. And he would actually take spots from any – well, not from anybody, but, you know, for me, I'm calling myself anybody because who am I really? But I've known him forever, and I would tell him, well, I saw Terry Funk do this one time in a barbed wire match, and all it was that Terry came out to the ring with a towel and ripped the towel on the barbed wire just to prove it was real barbed wire. And, you know, yeah. He did that, and, you know, but I was thrilled for him. That's, I mean, I know I'm saying in a long winded way, but just to see him do that, that was part of his dream. The other part was to be Jerry Lawler, of course, but he, you know, the other part of his dream was to make it huge in the wrestling business. And like you guys said, that was the height right there.
Yeah, totally. And why everybody needs to watch the Clash match from the day before, Clash 4. Where him and Ron Simmons was the Fantastics. It's a babyface match, but man, was it good. And Eddie was so good in that match. You know, and Pete's right. I mean, he was always better as a heel, but man, he was so good at playing babyface in that match.
Yeah, I mean, he's an underrated babyface. I mean, it's not like, even though he was much better as a heel, it doesn't mean he was a bad babyface.
Yeah, oh, no. Well said.
No, yeah. totally.
Yeah, he was a great worker, like as a babyface as well. Yes. It's just, you know, where he would get his, I don't know, a notoriety, push, heat, whatever you want to call it. That it was as a heel, but he was great, you know, and he became great. But then again, I saw him when he started, so he was like a little scrawny kid when he started. So, yeah. You know, and they were putting him over in Memphis before they should have, in my opinion, when he broke in and then was teaming with his father. But he really developed and, you know, it's just as solid as could be.
Totally.
And he had this run of a few months, he just had some of my favorite matches of his too. Between that tag, the tag with Steamboat, the Wyndham match, the Flair match on TV, just... And how much within a couple months?
How much longer was it after that he was part of the booking committee? Because I know I went to a couple shows in Miami and they were doing a battle royal, but he was organizing everything backstage, you know, and was telling guys what to do and all that stuff. So, you know, I remember that, and it couldn't have been later than 1989.
Yeah, no, it was spring 89 when George Scott got fired. Yeah, that they put together the committee.
Yeah, I want to say summer. Summer's more of a realistic, you know, than all that was going on. So,
I think he started in the spring, and then in the summer was when he got fired from the booking committee.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, him and Flair had their issues, which has been talked about. But
and which we talked about extensively, I think, on the 1987 show.
Exactly. Now we get to the what I call the Steve Beverly section of the show, as our good friend Steve Beverly of the vastly underrated Matt Watch newsletter brings us these tidbits. As he reported, the new venue for the WCW tapings in early 1989 will take place in an old dinner theater inside CNN Center that seats around 6,000 people.
I think it said 600.
600. That was my typo. So 600 people. And would provide a greater ambiance for the show. Now, Bix, of course, he's talking about center stage, which was not inside CNN Center,
to say the least.
And you know, pretty a good distance down the road from CNN Center, but it did have a better ambiance to Techwood. I'll give it that.
Yeah. I mean, there are things about this that are sort of accurate, even though most of it is not. Like, I mean, I think I asked you this when we were looking this over. Like, as a former center stage regular, just exactly how far were they, and how different would you say the two parts of town were?
All right, CNN Center's more midtown. It's right there. If you go to Atlanta, it's right there beside the Georgia Dome. It's in the Omni. You know, in the old Omni, you know, where the Omni was at. It's the Phillips Arena and all that area. So that's right there. Meanwhile, center stage is down the road. I'd probably say, maybe 5 miles, but it's in southwest Atlanta. And it's not in the best section of town. Let's put it that way. Lots of crime going on in that area. And if you go by there now, it's a dingy building, but, yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it was an interesting place to go, to watch wrestling at. So,
do you guys think this had something to do with Herd and the whole idea where they used to have the St. Louis tapings in a hotel with people with their, you know, dressed up in sort of like a dinner type atmosphere, and he just thought, hey, we'll repeat the success.
Maybe. Well, I'm also curious, like, if the CNN Center dinner theater actually existed.
Well, CNN had an atrium. And if you remember, they were going to hold a Clash of the Champions inside the CNN Center.
That was Clash 20, right? The anniversary show.
No, it was not that one. It was the one with Ric Flair and Scott Steiner as the main event.
That's right. What? But didn't Clash 20 get moved from somewhere else too?
I can't remember off the top of my head, but the Ric Flair Scott Steiner match was definitely moved to Gainesville.
Right.
Yeah, because but in the advertisements, it advertised at CNN Center, not the Omni. So in the atrium at CNN Center, which is a huge atrium, so they could do a show in there, and it would have looked like the first Nitro if they would have held it there. You know how that
which was
looked.
A great looking show.
Yeah, so that would have been what the Clash looked like then. Now, regarding the questions you brought up, Pete, about the dinner theater thing, I think mainly they just want to get out of Techwood. And more to look more like a, I guess, professional product, I would say, maybe.
Well, my thing was, you know, just because, I'm friends with Cornette, too, and it's just sort of like getting my little thing in there about just never underestimate the stupidity of Jim Herd.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So, any kind of wacky idea, you know.
His reputation precedes itself, that's for sure. Yeah. Now, Steve Beverly also reported that early in 1989, the NWA Saturday Morning Show will feature a rookie competition where the jobbers will compete against each other on a point system in a year-long tournament. Well, this never happened.
I think they did start booking a few jobber versus jobber matches, though, didn't they?
Yeah, but it wasn't what this was.
But they were making a concerted effort to book jobber versus jobber matches like Watts did in 93, right?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe this was the forerunner of them doing the thing where they gave Jimmy Hart Saturday Night Show, like, much later on.
Yeah. And they had a good little crew of, like, underneath guys that they were using.
Like the Italian Stallion.
I swear, I was just going to say that. Maybe it was a vehicle to, you know.
Well, they had guys like Greg Evans and Richard Sartain are two guys that come to mind who would become the Ding Dongs. They were guys that had worked for Deep South, Joe Hamilton's group, had been pushed there, but now are working in this area as, basically jobbers. And they were, pretty good. So it could have been a spotlight for guys like that. Let's put it that way. But like I said, it didn't happen.
Can you imagine that tournament? With the
that would have been a good way to like bring in a ringer and like somebody that nobody really knew a lot about and bring him in that role and put him over that way.
So who would be the Rob Van Dam in the underdog challenge of the 1988-89 Jobber Challenge series?
I'm guessing Spartacus Flair.
You think this would have been a way to, like, debut somebody like Pillman? You because Philman was in Stampede, and really, who was watching a lot of Stampede other than like the hardcores that knew about
it? But it got more it had more magazine attention at the time than it had before because of Owen.
Yeah, but still, it's still Stampede. You know, it's not like he was working in America. I mean, they could have done different things. It could have been a way to get over Sid Vicious, too, when they brought him
They're
in.
Not going
to
bring in Sid Vicious as part of the Jobber Tournament Challenge.
Well, it wasn't going to be a Jobber Tournament, of course, by name. Maybe a Young Lion Cup or something like New Japan run. Or some shit like that.
Or the All Japan, what did All Japan call their version? Asanaru Cup?
Yeah. Now, Steve Beverly also reported that the TBS brass was so upset with the World Championship Wrestling show that aired on December 10th, the one that was taped on the 8th, that they threatened to pull any future show that low in quality and replace it with an edited down Clash of the Champions. They were also upset with David Crockett not playing along with Paulie Dangerously on the December 10th morning show as he kept ruining Paul's act.
Shocking.
Wow.
What episode of World Championship Wrestling was that, though?
Oh, God. I read the lineup on Graham's site, Graham Coffin's site, historyww.com, and it is horrific. Like, there's jobber names. There's no first names. Like, it's most of them are all just last names.
Okay.
So let me try to go to it real quick. But I mean, it was pretty bad, and that television show, so I mean, it was just so stacked with jobber matches.
But I'm just trying to figure out what makes it different from the past shows.
All right, the December 10th show was taken on December the 5th, not December the 8th.
Okay.
I was wrong. All right, here's your matches: the Fantastics versus Allen and Jones,
the Russian Styles.
No, the Russian Assassins versus Jonathan Holliday and Eddie Sweat.
Eddie Sweat, one of the all-time great TBS shop.
The Road Warriors versus Reno Riggins and Steve Casey.
That could actually be a decent match.
The Texas Broncos versus the Cruel Connection.
Oh, dear God in heaven.
Eddie Gilbert and Ron Simmons versus Bear Colley and Justice. I can't remember what his name was.
Mike Justice?
Mike Justice, yeah. The Midnights versus Curtis Thompson and El Negro. The Commandos versus Keith Steinborn, and I'm guessing this is Randy Hogan. Bam Bam Bigelow versus Craig Brown. Rick Steiner versus J.D. Wolf. Barry Windham against Gary Royal. Condrey and Rose versus Jerry Price and the Menace. And your main event, and I'm guessing this is for the TV title too, Mike Rotundo versus the Italian Stallion.
There it is. I was waiting for him.
Well, you know what it sounds like? It's that they had something that they tried to push as the main event, which had a job guy, and also that there were just so many squash matches on the show. It sounds like the sheer number is ridiculous.
Well,
even for a two-hour show.
Tell me if I'm wrong, just reading through this, is that they're talking about just a line right above where he's talking about having the Saturday morning show with the rookie competition. And if I'm reading this right, they said they're set with David Crockett not playing along with Paulie on the 12:10 morning show. Are they trying to get all these guys a little bit of TV exposure? I know they're being jobbed out, but you know, and maybe using some of the guys that won on the lower names or something. I mean, I don't know. Just is there any connection, I guess I'm asking?
I've seen some of those Saturday morning shows from 89. And basically, it was the David Crockett show with, you know, different guest hosts. Like Paul would do it. Dylan would do it. Cornette would do it. Yeah, basically the managers, other than Ellering, would do it.
And Paul Jones.
And Paul Jones. But it was basically, you know, just the normal Saturday morning type show. You know, squash matches, mm-hmm. promos, David Crockett being David Crockett, and, you know, no selling Paul Heyman.
Nothing that mattered.
Well, on the other end, could this have been part of the reason that the plug got pulled, if that really was a real idea, that they realized they had to go a different way? Mm-hmm.
But David Crockett was not there too much longer after, you know, the turnover happened.
Well, he was there, just not as an announcer.
Yeah, he was, of course, he went behind the scenes. But he wasn't on the air anymore. In fact, if I remember right, I think Ross ended up taking over the Saturday morning show. And Ross was doing, like, all the shows at that time period. All the television.
Well, the Jimmy Hart thing, you know, in every cloud, baby, there's a silver lining, you know. Well, if they had helped him get rid of David Crockett a little faster, you know, at least something good came out of this.
Yeah, maybe. Now, in our final NWA note, Steve Beverly also floated out that some people from Turner had made an informal offer to Hulk Hogan, which he told was too low for him to consider.
Okay, so knowing... Okay, so I'm trying to think about this, because we honestly don't know what he made in the WWF. We know
not
there was
at that
a
time, we don't.
No, I mean, we know there was a guarantee. We know what kind of numbers he left for to go to WCW. I mean, well, he didn't leave WWF in 94, but you know what I mean. To give up on going back to WWF for years when he went in 94. I'm going to guess that they... But I just think, would they have put out just a singular dollar figure, or would they have done what Bischoff did?
I don't know. You got to look at this, you know. We know that they talked to Savage. We know that they talked to Piper. Mm-hmm. I think they were just trying all the top WWF guys to see, hey, what would it take for you to leave?
Yeah.
That's basically what they were doing.
And you got to remember, too, we're way in the infancy of all this stuff where, you know, the contract stuff that came up later isn't there yet.
Well, they're giving out guaranteed deals. You know, I mean, Luger had the guaranteed contract by this time. Flair had his guaranteed contract around this time.
Iron Sheik.
Iron Sheik came late.
You know what I mean. You get with the point I'm making, though.
Yeah, so they're giving out guaranteed money. So, I mean, but it's interesting, though, that none of the big-name WWF guys they talked to made the jump.
Well, Hogan had not really lost any steam yet.
And Hogan also had No Holds Barred coming out soon. So that would be kind of interesting to see him leave while WWF has this movie that they're involved with Hogan. You know, so I can definitely understand why he wouldn't have left. Why should he?
And I don't know what the price of steroids were back in that day, but you may have to follow this for a second. But I'm pretty sure that if, let's say, for instance, allegedly or something like this could happen in a cartoon, that Hogan or someone else might have been getting that stuff shipped, but not in his name, to maybe – you know, McMahon or something, and you can't write that in a contract. And perhaps maybe that was part of his payment, and they couldn't put that in the WCW contract. So, because you couldn't put it in writing, and he didn't trust him to do it. So there you go. And that, I think that's what put the whole fly in the ointment.
Well, and also, Dr. George Zahorian also saw him for a legitimate medical issue.
Yeah, and you know, part of that could have been not traveling too far away from the good doctor at any time, and they didn't run enough in Pennsylvania for him, you know, to justify moving to WCW.
Although,
I think we just figured it out.
Yes. I know I'm getting outside of the joke into real life, but I do remember that I think also didn't they ship steroids to Hogan? I mean, Zahorian also shipped steroids to a friend of Hogan's in Florida.
I heard that.
No, I mean, I remember who it was. I don't remember who the guy was, but I remember the name Dan Brower. Sound right?
Something like that, or Ed Leslie. Something. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, we know there are certain things that Ed Leslie can hook you up with. Like anthrax.
Let's not go there.
Well, yeah, there are several things. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting, but hopefully we started a few new rumors. There you go.
I don't think we started any new rumors.
And now we're going to take a little different approach in the show, as normally we would do one American group, then go to Japan, but we're going to do a second American group because the AWA has the big show of the week in the legendary Super Clash 3. But there's a lot of drama ahead of the show. As the Illinois State Athletic Commission met
When was there not drama with this show?
there's always drama. When the Illinois State Athletic Commission met on December 9th to make their official decision on whether Kerry Von Erich will compete at the Superclass show on December 13th, because Titan Sports was trying to basically sabotage the show. The deal was that the commission had a statute in their books which prohibits anyone using an artificial limb from competing in events. This stemmed from the deal where Colonel DeBeers accidentally pulled Kerry's boot off during a match in Las Vegas where everyone saw he was missing a foot, and Titan found out, so they tried to use their significant influence with the commission to sabotage the show. Titan got the influence due to their regularity of running shows in the state, which brought in quite a bit of taxes, which gives the commission revenue. The commission was in a catch-22 because, yes, the statute was there in their books since the 1920s, but the fact that he has worked in the state since he lost his foot and they didn't have him checked to begin with, it would make them look really bad. They were also scared of a fan backlash if they made such a decision. So after Titan gave an injunction to cancel the show, the meeting that was scheduled for December 14th was moved to December the 9th, which was on a date that Kerry couldn't be there because of New Japan commitments. The hearing took place that morning, and the commission found a loophole to allow Kerry to work the show, saying that since Kerry and Jerry Lawler aren't competing in an actual contest, but an exhibition of wrestling holds, that the statute didn't apply. The commission also noted it is within its powers to grant waivers on that statute, and it has been done before with a boxer. There were people ready to come to the hearing to make fools out of Titan Sports for making such a big deal out of something that was untrue to begin with. Larry Zbyszko was on ice, though, as he had been contacted by the AWA to take Kerry's place if he had been ruled ineligible. Now, the major irony here is that everyone involved with Superclass 3 is denying that there's anything to the story of Kerry missing his foot, with Kerry's agent claiming that the reason he always showers with his boot on is because of the ankle brace inside his boot. And then Rob Russin of the AWA said in radio interviews that he was in Las Vegas the night of the supposed incident and nothing of the like happened. Of course, World Class is in heavy denial of the story, but when Kerry returned to action the year before, there was an insurance form that he had to sign that had amputee on it, but Kerry said it was a misprint. Dave Meltzer went on to say that he talked to several ringsiders of the Vegas show, and they all told him that the incident happened with photo evidence of Kerry with his foot underneath the ring, putting his boot back on, but he hadn't seen the photo himself. There was a moment of stunned silence among the 1,500 fans of the show, with Kerry freaking out over the deal, and the Bears, quote, almost having a stroke, unquote, as according to the ringsiders, when the boot came off, there was a sock, but no foot. Dave said that he may wind up owing some people some major apologies over this one, but still, when it comes to believing the word of friends of his and the words of people doing business with Kerry, he would make the easy judgment call. Dave did take a shot, though, at Tight Sports, saying that why are they even getting involved in this? It was like, say, Road Warrior Animal picking on Downtown Bruno, as there's no competition between the two promotions. But they are so upset with being a monopoly that they would do whatever it takes to get there. AWA did buy ad time on WS Television Chicago over the weekend and air 5 ads promoting the show.
Okay, so many things to talk about here.
All right.
So first of all, what are the odds that one of those friends at ringside in Las Vegas has a name that rhymes with Tyke Monet?
Yeah, I would definitely think that he was part of that crew, yes.
Okay, Pete, as someone who was always tied in with the whole wrestling photography community, have you ever talked to anyone who has seen this photo or seen the photo? Because it's never surfaced.
What I heard was, and maybe I remember this wrong, but in my head, I remember them saying that they went around and I hope I'm not confusing with something else, but that they went around and making sure that they got rid of the film or didn't publish it or something like that. That was the excuse that I had heard. Now, have I ever seen the photo? No. Do I have like photos from pretty much everything? Yeah, but I don't know who was there at the time either. I guess we could sit there and watch it taping, right? It was a taping that happened at.
No, it was a house show.
It was a house show.
My guess being that they were contractually obligated to do a show, but since they taped all the TV in Jarrett's territory,
that's going to be discussed in the next little paragraph. But go ahead.
Yeah, so when you're going to Vegas and who would have been shooting there, and you know, Carrie was still working in Japan, so it's possible someone was, but there are shows that no one's shooting, and especially if it's a house show. But I did hear something. I'm trying to see, but I don't remember if that was something or something else where they made everybody like they get rid of their film and all this other stuff. So I don't know if it was that particular incident or something else we carry. I just seem to remember that. But you know, house show is a house show. You don't know that someone's there shooting it.
So I guess we're just going to take a stab in the dark. It would be a Japanese photographer like Jimmy Suzuki.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah.
You know, interesting to use the word stab using him, but that's okay. With this whole Memphis angle, but go ahead.
And I'm only using his name because he's the Japanese photographer everyone associates with shooting the U.S.
Yeah, and again though, but a minor house show, you know, I don't know what the rest of the card was. There are times where no one's shooting.
Here's the card.
Okay.
All right. November 12th at the Showboat, 1,500 fans. Jay Strongbow Jr. fought Del Wilkes to a draw.
Wait, Jay Strongbow Jr. would be
Frank Hill.
Yeah. No, the other one.
Other one, right. Yeah, he came out to
Mark Scarpa?
No, the one that worked California Championship Wrestling with Victor Rivera and all those guys in the 80s.
Oh, okay. That's right.
All right. Then you had Medusa over Magnificent Mimi.
It does bear – I don't want to interrupt you, but I believe that was the one that came out to the that song, you know, Kimisabe, Jump On It, Jump On Tanto.
Apache.
Yeah.
That's right. He sure did. Carry Over the Beers. That was the third match on the show. Your AWA World Tag Title match, Bad Company over John Paul, subbing for Robert Gibson, and Ricky Morton by DQ.
That could actually be a really good match.
And your main event – speaking of real good matches – AWA World Heavyweight title, Jerry Lawler defeated Wahoo McDaniel by DQ. So that's
So going by that, I'm guessing someone was there shooting. Who knows? Especially when you say, you know, it's never surfaced in all this time.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Bix, I mean, the commission meeting – It's kind of convenient that they ever happened when Carrie was in Japan, wasn't it?
Yeah. Now, hasn't the story over the years kind of been told though, is that the meeting got delayed till after the pay per view, so WWF gave up?
Well, no. I just read what happened.
I know, but I'm saying, hasn't that the story? How the story's usually been told over the years?
I think so. That's what I had heard.
Yeah, because when I saw this, I was like, at first I'm thinking, oh, okay, so it's in their meetings happening because Kerry's in Japan and blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. I think it could be a coincidence though, depending on when Titan alerted them, because this is only a few days before the pay per view that he's still in Japan, and you know who knows what the timeline is on. I mean, it was probably also a little. I'm sure it probably was at least partially by design too. But I think there's enough of the circumstances that it could also have just happened.
Well, they screwed it up because the meeting was supposed to take place the day after. And Titan got the injunction to try to cancel the show.
Yeah.
So they had to move it up.
Who were the people – I'm just going to reread this. And who were the people – there are people ready to come to the hearing to make fools out of Titan Sports for making such a big issue of something that was untrue to begin with.
Yeah, was that people from AWA World Class there to say that he had a foot or that he had 2 feet?
Yes, it was representatives, yeah. It's like, this is all false. Kerry has 2 feet. Yeah, those type of people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Imagine if it had ever gone to like something resembling a normal trial or something.
If they were under oath that's not.
Well, here's the thing. Interesting thing. Here's Zabisco. As Zabisco was still working for the NWA, although he had been in a car wreck and was missing time because he was recovering from those injuries. So, and of course, he would show up in AWA on the first TV show of 1989.
Which is first TV show or first TV taping?
The first TV taping, I guess you could say, yeah.
Was that the one where he won the title?
No. This is in January.
I thought he won the title in January.
No. They won the title in, like, April.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is like, yeah, they're still taping, like, the old AWA tapings. This was like Morocco was there and stuff like that. Yeah. Lawler was still champion. In fact, they were building up Lawler's Zbyszko matches.
So wait, where were those tapings?
In like their old, like wherever they were taping, like their, I don't know if it's North Dakota or stuff like that.
Oh, like in Minot, North Dakota or whatever.
Yeah, they were doing, yeah, they were still taping in those venues that time period.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting story about Zbyszko, but,
This is among the pettiest things they did in the wrestling war, on a large scale, at least.
I'm sure you guys are up on this. When exactly did Zbyszko start dating Gagne's daughter?
Oh, that's already been done, I think, at this time period.
Yeah, right. I think it was for a while.
So,
yeah.
You know, there's a little connection anyway.
Totally. Now, we had mentioned this while ago, heading into Super Clash 3, AWA hasn't had any new television on ESPN in well over a month, and their last fresh TV taping they had was on September the 19th. AWA is claiming to have a $66,000 advance going into the show, but Dave Meltzer thinks that is total fiction. While they are doing Super Clash updates on these shows that are airing with Lee Marshall, they aren't promoting any matches, and then you have World Class, who basically has given up on the show, as they put Lawler versus Kerry 3 nights later in Dallas, saying whoever wins that Super Clash would give the loser an immediate rematch, which tells their fans that a Super Clash match doesn't really matter. Amazing.
Maybe they booked the payments on the $66,000 advance plus, you know, the obvious huge walk up they were going to get. And maybe that's why no one got paid. You ever think
maybe
that?
Maybe. Crazy. Now on to the show on December 13th at the USC Pavilion in front of 1,700 fans, $26,000 gate, so they didn't get that 66, and 3,000 freebies.
So wait, it's 1,700 paid then, not 1,700 paid total. Okay.
Yeah, 1,700 paid. Yeah,
and so 4,700 total.
Yeah, you had Chavo, Hector, and Mondo Guerrero going over Cactus Jack and Rock and Roll RPMs. You had Eric Embry winning the World Class Light Heavyweight title from Jeff Jarrett. Jimmy Valiant going over Wayne the Train Bloom. Iceman Keith Parsons over Brickhouse Brown. The Top Guns, Derek Dukes and Ricky Rice and Wendy Richter over Bad Company and Medusa. AWA television title, Greg Gagne over Ronnie Garvin by countout. Lingerie Battle Royal won by the Terrorists. The Boot Camp match, Charlotte Slaughter over Colonel the Bears by DQ. World Class Tag Title, Samoan SWAT Team retaining over Steve Cox and Michael Hayes. Indian Strap match, Wahoo McDaniel over Manny Fernandez. Then you had the Studs battling Rock and Roll Express to a double DQ. And your title versus title match, Lawler over Kerry via blood stoppage.
So, you know, my first thing reading back over the card, the first thing that comes to mind is you have good talent and good workers on that card. They just had way too many matches.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, totally. Yeah, and you know, you think about it, okay. The thing about the Greg Gagne match and Ronnie Garvin was it was, you know, Ronnie Garvin was on his way to WWF. He really could have missed the show.
Actually, wait a second. When was the Greg Valentine, the first Greg Valentine match at the Garden before they feuded?
In December of 1988, I think, wasn't it?
So what date?
I don't know. I have to look at the results.
Yeah, I'll look that up. You talk.
Okay. So, and that's what Dave said in the Observer. He's like, give Garvin credit for, honoring his commitments when he didn't have to. And the Lingerie Battle Royal. Oh, boy. Yeah. This is what Dave Meltzer said about the Lingerie Battle Royal. First off, presenting this TNA crap as pro wrestling shows just what the promoters involved really think of their products. Second, while the largely male crowd did get into the match waiting for clothes to get torn off, it couldn't have sold many tickets. Well, nothing sold many tickets. And whenever you reach so far, you lose the center and it costs you tickets. If there's a market for POWW and David McClain can keep it going financially, then good for him. But it was being presented as a pro wrestling here, and it was a huge blight on the wrestling profession. As bad as Larry Nelson and Lee Marshall were as announcers for this show, and both were embarrassing, David B. McClain comes across as the Jim Baker of the wrestling business and a most obnoxious version.
So for Ron Garvin, the first WWF match that Graham Coth on site lists is November 19th.
Wow.
So he had already been the WWF for a month.
Wow, that's something. All right, this is Dave talking about the match. This is hilarious. Of course, every elimination came from being over the top rope, but they're supposed to be stripped down to their lingerie. Well, Peggy Lee did lose her blouse, but she looks like Jan Valo, the old roller derby skater.
Of course.
And this is Dave's notes to that. For those who are going to get mad at the sexist remarks here, remember the context of this match invites them, and it was presented as softcore perversion.
Perversion?
The terrorist won when she threw Brandy Mae out. The wrestling was awful. Although Luna, Dick Slater's wife, took a nice bump about 6 minutes in. Brandy Mae also had her blouse torn off.
By the way, I believe that Luna was Dick Slater's girlfriend at the time, but wouldn't Sean's daughter be a more appropriate...
There's all kinds of stuff there, is whether they were married or not. It was a wrestler's wedding, and God knows. I know way too much about that, so...
I mean, just who knew that Luna was married to a wrestler that wasn't one of the Blackhearts?
Exactly. All right, more Dave greatness. The lingerie battle royal was better than what came next. A 320-pound relic of the wrestling boom called Sergeant Slaughter and a Blue Cat Magic Colonel of the Beers. There's nothing sadder than watching washed-up wrestlers try and recreate their former magic and get no response. All right, nobody cares about Sarge. Lee Marshall voice booms and says how the crowd is chanting USA, USA. In the background, we hear no noise except for one woman who screams from ringside, Slaughter, you suck. At one point, there was a USA chant for a brief moment. Talking about how Adnan ran in and attacked Slaughter. Then came the Iron Sheik. Dave said he was waiting for Hans Schmidt, Kurt Von Hess, and Mr. Moto to run out so Vern could jump out of the broadcast booth and run them all off.
That's awesome.
Negative one star. All right.
Mean positive one star if it's double negative one star?
Yeah.
Now you're throwing my math teacher gimmick in there. You come on.
All right, think about this now. Tatsumi Fujinami was introduced at this card. You have Fujinami there, and you don't put him in a match. It says Tatsumi Fujinami was introduced to the crowd before the Wahoo Manny Fernandez strap match, and Fernandez challenged him. For the record, Jarrett wanted Fujinami to work the show, but Vern and Greg said no.
And then you have him do an angle with a New Japan guy who he could have worked with, who was a great worker.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, there was all kind of stuff going on. And one thing about the Lawler carrier match, and Dave said there wasn't one wrestling move in the match, but the two got tremendous heat mainly because Lawler is a master working the crowd. And of course, you know, this is the match where carrier bladed himself on the way to the ring.
Yeah. You know, I thought I heard it was in the dressing room.
One or the other.
Yeah.
And that's why he taped it up and they tried to cover it up.
Although what happened was it was his arm. Like he tried to scratch his arm, forgetting he had a blade taped to his finger. Mm-hmm. So it must have been he was either in the dressing room or Lawler noticed when he took his robe off. Because the first spot of the match is Lawler charging at Carey and smashing his arm into the turnbuckle.
Yeah, he definitely was clued in. Now, this, of course, was like I want to say a ripoff of the Flair Luger finish, but it was. But Carey was bleeding enough, so at least it looked legit, unlike Luger. Even if in some ways this was more ridiculous, since it was the copy of a finish everyone had seen. The live crowd knew the finish because there was no false pop in them thinking Carey won, only booze because they knew. After the match, it was explained that Stanley Blackburn had been so appalled by the Blood and Wahoos match that he instructed the referees to not let this one get out of hand. After the match, they interviewed Stanley Blackburn and Kerry, and Kerry proved once again why his IQ measures lower than his biceps by crying that, quote, "I've never heard of a match stopped on blood before," unquote. After all of these years, Vern is still trying to make Stanley into the lead heel. Wow. All right. Yeah. The deal about the Rock and Rolls against the Stud Stable, they said the Rock and Rolls were supposed to win the AWA World Tag Team titles, but they no-showed separate shows, and that's why they didn't get the belt.
So that's why. So, and it was Bad Company were the tag champs, and then I'm trying to remember what they did it like a screwy finish because it was for both the tag titles and the women's titles, the Bad Company and Medusa versus Top Guns and Wendy Richter match.
Yeah,
and I forget what the screw fin. Oh, was it something like? I forget what the finish was though. They did something screwy. I just remember that, and it was like, was it maybe their one of the like they had Richter pin one of the men? So because it was, I think it's only one title would change, or was it both titles would change?
Okay, Derek Dukes subbed for John Paul. Although this is great, Derek Dukes was a sub for John Paul. Although no mention was made of that, but I guess Vern figured they looked so much alike that nobody would notice.
Because as we all know, of all wrestling promoters, Vern Gagne certainly does not see color.
Yeah, and John Paul's a white man with blondish brown hair, and Derek Dukes is a black man. It was billed that both the titles were at stake, although nobody, including the announcer, seemed to understand what they really meant. Tanaka kicked Medusa and then pinned her. No, second time Wendy ducked, Tanaka kicked Medusa and then came the pin. Medusa got a spanking afterwards. Dukes and Rice were announced as the AWA World Tag Team Champions. But the AWA seemed to forget about Dukes. But a few matches later, the announcers told us they made a mistake. And since the girl got pinned, the tag titles didn't change hands.
Okay, so right, the women's title did change hands, I guess.
Yes, yeah. Wow. Now, this is a... More stuff on the show. Greg Gagne made the classic babyface comment, complaining why the fans cheered Ron Garvin, saying Ron Garvin was like the Chicago Bears and he was like the Minnesota Vikings, that the Vikings are going to beat the Bears. Which
in says, Chicago.
Yeah, a tremendous babyface thing to say, and it won't help Greg in Minneapolis because they boo him even heavier there. By the way, the Bears already clinched the division, Greg. And then Kerry did three interviews repeating the same phrase over and over each time about there being only one Mona Lisa and one Leaning Tower of Pizza. And he did pronounce like the food, not the city. And one Eiffel Tower and only one world. That has to be a mistake because what about the one Kevin's in? So how could there be more than one world champion? And the best part of the show, of all this greatness, this is what our good buddy Dave Meltzer said was the best part of the show. Bill Apter went in to give Lawler an award for most inspirational wrestler after a girls' battle royal. Bill had this big speech about how Lawler had strived for 16 years to win a world title, never gave up, et cetera, et cetera. And here he is, Jerry Lawler, except there's no Lawler. Apparently, he was still negotiating the finish with Kerry at the time. So Cowboy Bill was standing there with egg on his face. No matter, after the next match, he went back to the dressing room with Apter got to present Lawler with the award. The only problem was that we had to hear the same speech a second time. And to take the cake, we had Larry Nelson out with Lawler showing a film of the last time these two met. A clip from September 17th in Nashville was shown. And, of course, the two have met only 500 times since then. And they cut the clip right after Kerry pinned Lawler with a pile driver. Never explained it was overruled because of CWA rules. It left us all wondering why they have a rematch to begin with and why Kerry doesn't already have both belts. Then Larry utters the classic words about Kerry, quote, "He's had trouble with his leg," unquote.
I forgot that Larry Nelson was still around at this point.
Oh, man.
When did Larry Nelson leave?
80, he was still there in 89.
I thought he left in 88. I thought Marshall replaced him. Or Mick Hart replaced him, and then Marshall replaced.
He was still there in 89. Well, here's more great stuff. The pay-per-view hosts were thrown for a loop when all those in the Dallas area were unable to get the show. There you go. That's why you had your match 3 days later. When, due to a malfunction at some junction, and because of Kerry's name value, Dallas was supposed to be a market that they could do some pay-per-view business, and, of course, they put the rematch 3 days later. There's a new belt being made, although there's a disagreement on that. Jared is having a new undisputed title made for Lawler, but Vern wants to keep his own AWA champion, so we'll see how that game winds up being played.
Okay, finally, so wait, I have to interrupt for a second. Okay, so in real life, Vern was on the side of Lawler's kayfabe excuse for why he was vacating the AWA title?
Yes. And finally, give them credit for holding the show together as well as they did. There is only one no-show from the program, several less than it appeared there would be just the week before showtime. There were several changes from the original lineup penciled in mid-September, but given the chaotic nature of pro wrestling today, particularly small promotions, none of the headline matches were affected. Byrne didn't even want Fujinami on television, but several folks somehow talked him out of it. Apparently, Fernandez was a key factor in this, realizing it would get his photo and the confrontation in all the Japanese magazines, which is important since the great majority of Fernandez's income in wrestling comes from Japan.
There's
Burn on you, everyone!
I've got a note that you guys don't have here that Vern also, his idea to get Fujinami on the show, he did agree to let him in the lingerie battle royal, but when Fujinami refused, that's when he refused to put him on TV.
Well, we've seen some of those Japanese weddings that they've aired, the wrestler weddings. And there's someone always like cross dressing, so he probably could have done something like that.
Wait, really? I don't remember that on any of the new.
Toriano was the notorious one.
Okay, that's right. I remember that.
That's when he started getting pushed.
That's right. That's right. I forgot about that. It was when, because there was that period where there were like three weddings in 4 months or something.
Yeah, he was at Nagata's wedding and dressed up as a woman and or a young girl or something, but he was cross-dressing, and then it wasn't that long after that they started pushing him.
Those New Japan ESPN shows were great because you get the weddings, and you get, like, I remember when during Super Juniors they had this thing where they interviewed Shocker, Wagner, and Silver King all in English, and those were fun.
Yeah.
And one thing I did want to mention that I always love with the – it's not specific to Super Clash itself, but yeah, because you were talking about the way they presented the screw job in the first well, not the first, but the Nashville Kerry Lawler match. I always, it's such a screwy finish, but I always loved the way they explained it because it feels like the type of thing that could actually get overlooked, that it's the pile driver's illegal in world class, so Kerry should be able to hit a pile driver and, you know, win, but then the Tennessee State Athletic Commission is who bans the pile driver, not the CWA or the AWA. So the pile driver is illegal. So therefore, since titles change hands on disqualifications in world class, Lawler should win the title from Kerry. But if the AWA title, et cetera, et cetera, the whole loop of what was and wasn't legal and what happened with the disqualification, I just thought it, in a weird way, it made sense.
Well, they actually did that with the NWA versus WWF thing with the Super Bowl of Wrestling as well, with the whole thing with the DQ over the top rope that the NWA had that the WWF did and all that stuff. And
that was Race and Graham, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And then they did the rematch, and by that time it was Backlund and Race, but they did do that. And also, I don't remember, but I'm 99% sure that the Backlund versus Flair thing in Atlanta, they talked about it. I don't know if it played in the match. I was actually there too, but I do remember them talking about that as well. And I agree with you that putting the some sort of, as whacked out as it may be, plausible explanation made you buy into it a little bit more. You know, at least there's something that explains it.
Right, and it should be pointed out that those three nights of tapings that led into Super Clash were booked by Jerry Jarrett and not anyone in the AWA.
Yeah, and those were really fun shows, too. Mm-hmm. And AWA, even at this time period, when Vince was in the tank, I've watched all that stuff, you know, recently over the years, and it's entertaining. I mean, it may not be great, but it's entertaining as hell to watch this stuff. Yeah. And Jerry Lawler, 1988, was phenomenal. Turning heel, you know, nationally, and oh man, he was just so awesome in world class. He was awesome in all these roles, just fantastic. And Karen was a good opponent for him. You know, they had good matches.
He was the one guy that was able to make Kerry look like the old Kerry.
Exactly.
Well, if you ever saw, well, I'm sure you guys did, I shouldn't say if you ever saw, but all the stiffs that Lawler worked with in Memphis, and guys that barely, you know, never had a main event anywhere, could barely move or whatever, at least Kerry had some athleticism to him, as screwed up as he could be at one time, you know. So he knew how to work around guys like that.
But yeah, let's be honest. Kerry could have had two prostheses and still would have been better than Jesse DiBiase Ventura.
Well, there you go.
Or Man Mountain Mike.
And the list goes on and on and on.
Exactly. And this is a perfect segue, this whole Kerry Lawler stuff. So New Japan Pro Wrestling, as there's a special show held at Corken Hall 4 days before Super Clash on December the 9th in front of 2,200, where Tatsumi Fujinami defeated Kerry Von Erich to unify the world-class heavyweight title and the IWGP heavyweight title. But the match was stopped by blood stoppage after Fujinami used a steel chair on Kerry, then posted him and worked over the cut, forcing the stoppage. The match had originally went to a double countout, and they restarted the match. But Fujinami gave the world-class belt back to Kerry, though, after the match, saying that he didn't want to win the title that way. Also on that show, Shiro Koshinaka retained his IWGP Junior Heavyweight title, defeating Keiichi Yamada in Yamada's final appearance before, quote, taking a year-long tour of Europe, teaming with Masakatsu Funaki. Now, this wow. is...
This you just said a mouthful.
Yeah. Now,
yeah, that did not happen, but for several different reasons.
Yeah, Funaki, of course, is leaving, going to the UWF. And this was actually the last Keiichi Yamada match.
Whatever happened to that Yamada kid? I don't know.
Like a few months later, this Jushin Thunder Liger showed up, built a lot like Keiichi Yamada. And we all know what happened there. But let's get to Fujinami and Kerry
first. Jushin Liger was also the second guy to use the Shooting Star Press after Keiichi Yamada.
Wow.
That's right. Amazing how that happened.
Maybe he went to find his long-lost brother. Who knows? But anyway, go back to the Fujinami thing, because this is interesting.
It's an interesting finish considering what happens 4 days later. You know, the blood stoppage and everything. I mean... Wow. And, of course, Fujinami at this time period.
He's the best wrestler in the world.
He's the best wrestler in the world, and he's got all the titles to prove it. I mean, he's IWGP champion. He's, uncrowned world-class heavyweight champion. He was Pacific Northwest heavyweight champion. I think there was another belt in there somewhere he was holding.
He was all the champions. When was the Lawler match?
4 days later.
No, the Lawler Fujinami match.
Oh.
The month, maybe earlier.
And did they build that as title versus title, or?
Well, you know, they're supposed to have a match in Texas, and Jarrett canceled. He didn't want to do that. But that's when they made a Lawler carry.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember.
That was supposed to happen. After Super Clash.
I'm just trying to remember what the result of the Lawler-Fujinami match in New Japan
was. Well, Fujinami would work Memphis, and we'll talk about that when we get
to that. Right, that's right. I think they had a match at the Mid-South Coliseum, didn't they?
And not Jerry Lawler and Tatsumi Fujinami.
I think Fujinami did work Memphis at the Coliseum.
Oh, he did. Yeah. Like I said, we'll talk about it later. But, Fujinami definitely worked the show, but not against Lawler. But, Fujinami was... ridiculous at this time period. Does this match exist on tape? I don't know if I've ever seen it.
I know I've seen photos.
Let's look at this a little bit, though. Do you think that was the planned finish? Do you... A couple more things.
You mean the planned finish for Chicago?
For Japan.
Oh.
Because... Yes. Okay, but... let's go with our logic now before when you were talking about that and how, you know, the different rules and all that stuff. Fujinami didn't want to win the belt that way, yet he hit the guy with a chair. He ran his head into the post. So you do that, and then you don't want the title because you did it to the guy. I know they needed a way out, obviously.
I guess the deal was he didn't want to win without pinning Kerry. He felt like a referee stoppage wasn't the right way to go. That wasn't noble. Kerry didn't have any say in the finish.
And maybe this did filter in Vern not wanting Fujinami on there because he bloodied up his main eventer a few days before. And, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, another thing is AWA and New Japan weren't, you know, really working together. So that may have been another reason, too. Which AWA wasn't really working with All Japan either this time. So who knows? It's Vern. I mean, that's a tough nut to crack. But I want to talk about Shiro Koshinaka.
What a great wrestler.
When he was a junior heavyweight, people don't really think about this era of Koshinaka. He was having great matches with everybody. You know, just a fantastic worker.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about over and over on these shows lately, like how much I love his team with Muto, which was kind of coincided with the junior run. But his feud with Takada is legendary. I'm trying to remember if I've seen this specific match. I think I have. Owen Hart, just everything he did as a junior heavyweight was great. And even, you know, he never really got a great singles push. I mean, he got a little bit of a tag team push around, when was it, like 90, 91?
Yeah, he didn't get singles push until he started, but when he was the leader of HI.
Yeah, I don't know why, though. I mean, he really didn't slow down as a worker until, like, what would you say, 99?
Oh, he was still a good worker in the 2000s. I say he didn't really start slowing down until maybe 2002.
Well, that's what I say. I mean, I don't think he really lost a step until, like, around then. Like,
he was still good. I mean, yeah, I guess what you're saying. He wasn't at a top level in the early 2000s, but he could still do things. He could still go.
Right.
He was still a good worker.
Now, for current New Japan fans who have not seen enough older New Japan, now, I know you guys don't really like Ryusuke Taguchi, but I know you probably know that he got the hip attack funky weapon stuff sort of from Koshinaka.
Ass-based offense.
Yes, Koshinaka was much, 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 much better than Taguchi could ever be.
Yeah. The master of the ass fence.
Now, who's someone younger or newer that we could compare him to? Like, who would, because he was very smooth in the ring, but like I can't think of anyone other than like the hip attack stuff that you can really use to compare him to.
I can't really think of anybody either. You know,
like very high energy, like a lot of very good leaping ability. Like I remember really liking or at least what I saw of his match with Sting, because they worked very well together. Yeah, I can't really think of anyone that you would say, like, if you like this guy, you'd like Koshinaka. I mean, other than just to say that he was a great worker.
How about, I think you guys are missing the obvious comparison here, saying this nowadays, superstar or diva, Naomi.
Well, as far as ass-based offense, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, she does. Yeah, she's a good leaper, too.
There you go.
Yeah, that's not bad. Definitely. So,
yeah.
And Goldust,
Koshinaka should have called it. He calls it the rear view.
Yeah, and Goldust, you know, implemented some of the ass based offense in his repertoire later on.
Yeah, that's true. On a serious note, yes.
Yeah. Well, as far as Japan goes, that's pretty much all that's going on. All Japan's got the Real World Tag League going on. But there's not, I mean, they're not into the big matches yet. And there's no real, I think, important matches going on. Although, I mean, there were some great, great tag teams in this tournament. One that's always remembered by me is the Jerry Blackwell, Phil Hickerson team that was in this tournament. And you had Gordian Hansen, of course, won the thing. Jumbo and Yatsu, Baba and Rusha Kimura, Abby and Tiger Jeet Singh, Kawada and Tenru, Johnny Ace and Dan Spivey, what a team that is, Jimmy Snuka in Tiger Mask 2. That's right. Snuka and Misawa. Great Kabuki in Hiroshi Wajima. Shinji Takano and John Tenta. And your last place team, in fact, tie for last place with Blackwell and Hickerson, Tommy Rich and Dick Slater. So that's your All Japan Real World Tag League.
And I guess if we ever do the following week, we'll talk about it more. But the finals of that tournament is one of the very greatest matches in All Japan history.
Exactly. Whenever we do that week, that will definitely come up. Well, now we're moving out of Japan and going to Canada. And so we're making this an international section. Stampede Wrestling's got a couple things going on. The British Bulldogs, Dynamite and Davey, won the international tag titles from the Cuban Commandos in a steel cage match on December the 7th in Calgary.
And the Cuban Commandos, of course, would be Cuban Assassin Angel Acevedo and Champagne Jerry Morrow. Though there were also the Cuban Assassins, as people might have seen on WWE Network before the Stampede shows were pulled. Now, do you know who the other Cuban Assassin was?
I know, but I can't remember his name.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But there was also in Memphis earlier that year, there was the Cuban Choir Boys, which was Acevedo and another guy, which I can't remember his name.
And Iranian Assassin in Memphis with Cuban Assassin was
Ali Hassan.
Wait, who was Ali Hassan, though? No, but what was he Jack Kruger?
No.
Why did I think that was Jack Kruger?
Ali Hassan would go on to become Sheik Abdullah.
Okay.
In Central States, if I'm not mistaken. Ended up becoming like, he was the guy in Continental with Chris Colt and all that stuff.
Yeah. Now, also, let's look at just how quickly the Bulldogs got the titles, because this is one of their first matches back in the territory. I mean, when was Survivor Series? What day?
It was in like November 26th, 7th, somewhere.
It was either Thanksgiving night or Thanksgiving Eve, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that one was Thanksgiving night.
Yeah.
So, yeah, yeah. I mean, that was their last match. They started back up in Calgary, and
Well, of course. Of course they were going to be the champions.
I know, but they didn't even build to it. It's a little, I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, that Dynamite and Davey are just, you know, they're natural there. So, of course, they're going to win. And Don Morocco captured a North American heavyweight title from Mukun Singh, Norman, any other aliases you remember. Mike Shaw, Bastion Booger, on December the 9th in Medicine Hat, Alberta. And Pete, you know, Don Morocco, of course, he would go to AWA not too long after this and work some. He was so big. They looked like he was about to explode. He was so juiced up in the bad way.
Yeah, and you know, Morocco is an interesting guy because I saw so many phases of him. You know, I don't think I've ever seen anybody that played four different roles so well. I mean, he was the pretty boy baby face. He was the badass baby face. He was the comedy heel, and he was the badass heel too. And every single one of those roles, he just did to perfection. You know, when he started, he was the Jack Briscoe clone, and that was the pretty boy one. And then he came back, and this is just for Florida, came back, and he was the kick-ass baby face. Then he did the whole heel turn and
the Magnificent M.
Yeah, Magnificent M, and that was the crazed baby, you know, crazed heel. But then he was the funny heel, but the guy could work and he could do every single role really well. And then we forgot the blown up the blown up baby face, right?
Yeah, just talking about.
One he didn't do well.
Yes, exactly. Heel. Yeah.
And fat, lazy heel Don Morocco for many years in WWE. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because people, I mean, there's a lot of people that don't really like Don Morocco among the newer fans. But the legend is, and of course you would know better than me since you were there, mm-hmm. when Don Morocco was in Florida, especially towards the later, like 79, 80, when he was heel, I mean, the stories were that he was like one of the best guys in the business.
Yeah, he was. There's no question. I would go to say that he just – the whole thing that everybody said, he didn't care enough. You know, I heard later on that, you know, he came from money. but everybody knew he was going back to Hawaii when he just, I don't want to say got bored with things, but pretty much he was just, he would just go back there all the time, and that wasn't work. So, you know, they never gave him a really big title outside of, I guess, the WWF giving him the Intercontinental title. You know, that was probably the biggest title he ever held, right?
Yeah, pretty much. And, yeah, it was the major title he held, yeah.
And reason I would am guessing on this, because he worked Florida so much, the weather is the most similar to Hawaii. I mean, you know, and he loved it here. And but he was effective, and he and Jake Roberts actually, right around that time frame you're talking about, did stuff that you didn't see anybody else do. And it wasn't, again, the same thing that turned me on to Florida wrestling to begin with. It wasn't light. It looked effective. It looked real. It was, I was talking about the difference between, I'm forgetting which luchador it was that did the leg drop off the top rope, that one.
Psicosis?
Yes, Psicosis versus a Bobby Eaton leg drop off the top rope. You know, the difference between it looks totally like when it lands. But those guys, you know, it wasn't that they were laying in, but it looked really good, and they did stuff you saw no one else do. And then Morocco, like you guys were saying, he was the first one to do that lazy heel thing and, you know, do the commentary during the match and stuff, his own match and all that, you know.
Seducing Cal Rudman during interviews.
Yeah.
Yeah, Morocco is something else, no doubt.
Yeah.
Now, I'm trying to remember, also, was Dynamite the booker from the moment he came back?
If it wasn't the moment, it was not too far after.
Because I thought he brought in Morocco.
So, yeah, it could have been. I mean, it could have been right there. It was in the time period. Yeah, so, I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, and if you're saying, like, if you look at that, he won the belt 2 days after the Bulldogs.
Yeah. Yeah, and Muck and Singh, of course, Mike Shaw. If people know Mike just from Norman, the Lunatic.
Well, he had matches as Norman, though.
I'm not talking about match-wise. I'm not talking about match-wise. I'm talking about performer-wise.
Yeah.
Watch him as Muck and Singh in Stampede. It's a totally different character. I mean, he is so good in that role.
As promos,
the beat of Karachi Vice.
Yes, promos, his work, even his commentary.
Yeah, very effective in that role.
I love that he would – have you ever seen the stuff he would do hosting the shows with Ed Whalen where he'd wear a muumuu?
Yes. I mean, a hilarious guy. And he showed that in Global for the short time he was there as part of the cartel.
Yep. He was back as Muck and Singh.
Yeah, he was back as Muck and Singh. So, yeah, Mike Shaw, another guy that doesn't get nearly talked about enough.
Well, because his highest profile run was Bastion Booger, where if he could still work, they didn't want him to, or he was done. And then after that was Norman, which, I mean, he had some good matches with Pillman and maybe a couple other guys, but still, he wasn't Muck and Singh. And then, yeah, I mean, too bad. It's too bad, because I think the vast majority of people who even remember him have any idea how good he was.
Exactly. And Pete mentioned Mexico and Luchadors real quick. A couple matches on the December 8th Arena Mexico show. Lola Gonzalez defeated Pantera Serena for her hair in a hair versus hair match. And Liz Marks Sr. defeated El Fabuloso Blondie, Ken Timms, for his NWA light heavyweight title. And Bix, Ken Timms, I'm a guy who, you know, journeyman around the States, good worker. But in Mexico, he was a really big deal for a short time period.
I don't even know how short a time period you'd say, because I don't think I realized he was there and getting a push this early. When did he start with CMLL?
Probably 88. He was around 88, because he was still working indies in 88. So this would have been, you know, not early in that run.
I say that because he was still a pretty big pushed heel through, what, 90, 91?
Yes.
So he had a pretty long run, and he was the first guy that really did the type of, you know, American anti-Mexican heel the way that really got popularized in the 90s. Like, if I remember correctly, the Gringo Loco nickname even started with him.
Yes.
And he was one of those guys, whether it was he was a smaller guy or just the type of guy who really, like, took to this, not only took the style, but just really had a lot of respect and love for Lucha Libre. Like, which you don't always see from guys of his generation, American wrestlers, especially from the South. But he loved it down there. And I mean, I remember talking to him about it and just how much respect he had for those guys and guys like, trying to think who he mentioned, like, you know, Ryo de Jalisco Jr. was one of his favorites to talk about, even though not always one of the, like, American hardcore lucha fans' favorite or the English.
Well, these are guys he worked against.
No, I know. But he had a lot of respect for him as a worker, though.
Yeah. I mean, he worked against mainly those guys. He went working against a lot of your lighter guys.
Well, he actually, I remember talking to him about Yael Dos Santos, though, and that he, I guess it was, well, I'm trying to figure, well, maybe it would have been based on when he worked with him that he felt like, or maybe said some other people felt like Santo kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, coasted on his name a little bit.
Yeah.
Which, kind of was the idea that he never would have to, because, the whole thing where his dad wanted him to be a good enough worker before he took the gimmick, and certainly became a great worker, so I don't know.
Oh, yeah, well, we've seen Santa from in the 80s, and he was awesome. Maybe took some nights off every now and then, but it is what it is. Now, regarding Ken Tim, this is a question for you, Pete. Ken Tim's the guy, and there's a lot of guys that were around in that mid to late 80s, and he's like a good example of, if they would have been born like 10 years earlier.
Even 5 years.
5 years earlier, they would have been bigger stars in the business. I mean, him, maybe Chick Donovan. Yeah, guys like that.
I wouldn't give Chick Donovan. Chick Donovan was old.
Well, started maybe earlier, but still. Yeah. I mean, guys like that, Tom Pritchard's another guy who I think would have been a bigger star if he would have been born earlier. I mean, what are your thoughts about guys like Ken Timms and their
Well, you saw what they could do, and they had, the places to do it were running out.
Yeah,
the time that they came in. So I agree with what you're saying completely. And the other thing about Timms as opposed to some of these other guys is that a lot of them wouldn't go to Mexico.
Oh, no way.
And I guess what I'm trying to say is re-emphasizing what you guys are saying is that this guy had a love for the business. And when you had that and you had that, it's not just the passion, but that love for the business and the idea that he would go to Mexico and he would go anywhere that would use him. I'm going to tell you something about Ken Timms. Ken Timms was a great jobber.
Yes, he was.
Okay, so what was it that he couldn't do outside of not having a lot of size, and maybe missing a little bit of an it factor, so to speak? But he would have been certainly like a tag team guy or a junior heavyweight and whatnot, like you said, if he had been born a little earlier.
Exactly. And this era, is starting a change in the business, and it's all about, being more athletic and having, a certain type of look, and guys like that are just starting to fall by the wayside. So, yeah.
And who knows how many more there would have been,
Yeah, and the thing about Timms was, and I think this plays a role in too, when he worked Southwest, in 83, 84, I mean, there were, Mexican guys coming through. They were working, that area, border towns and stuff. So that gives him a different outlook on it than some other guys would have. So I think that played a role in it too.
That's a great point.
Yeah, exactly. And see, Eric Embry and Dan Greer, the guy that replaced Timms, they went to Mexico on a regular basis in 85, working UWA.
That's right.
So I mean, that's probably where it came from. But on that note, we're going to take a quick commercial break and let the place to be boys pay the bills. And when we come back, we're going to go to the U.S. indie scene, what's left of it, and some interesting things going on in Continental as David Woods. Is he going to leave or what's going on with him? We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Laser Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlacemanNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Senior, as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlacemanNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, Lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, Wrestling Culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
And we're back, and listen to all those great shows you're advertised during the commercial, especially the ones that I am on, and of course, Bix is on too. And we are back discussing the week of December the 8th through the 13th, 1988, and we're in the U.S. Indie region, starting off with Continental Wrestling Federation, which has been having some issues over the recent months. And Steve Beverly and Matt Watch reported that there are serious rumors that David Woods, the owner of the company, may be trying to give Continental back to Ron Fuller. Steve tried to get in touch with Woods during the week, but he had no luck. Now, Dutch Mantell and Ken Wayne both quit Continental over low pay, as Wayne recently got a week's check for $160, and Dutch quit right as an angle when Tom Pritchard was heating up, going back to Memphis, but they tried to keep him around, but he demanded a guarantee, which they didn't meet. Now, Pete, you have had some dealings with David Woods over the years. Tell everyone about what David Woods was like as a wrestling boss, I guess.
Well, let's say this. We, you know, people don't realize this for the magic of recording stuff now, but you guys started this segment and you said something about Eddie Gilbert left him high and dry, and then all of a sudden everything went goodbye. So I think Eddie might have, you know, put his two cents in right there. But when you, I think it kind of sums it up right there when you see that payment of $160, and it was someone that had big ideas, didn't know anything to do with wrestling, and then Eddie had that place rolling. When you look at the guys, and I'm not saying that because of my relationship with him, I'm talking about as a wrestling fan. I would go out of my way to watch that show. I started shooting photos back then too, and it was a 90-mile drive from Tallahassee, Florida to Dothan, Alabama. But I would go out there, you know, it was on Saturday nights and stuff like that, and it was just great to watch. I mean, watch that time when Eddie was. Great workers, no question, and it was like poetry in motion watching those guys work together as a team or against each other. But those, look at how many guys he had over to the highest amount that those guys had ever been over in their lives in wrestling, and how entertaining the show was and how watchable it was. There, you know, Missy was there then, and Sid is Lord Humongous, and all that. You know, so you had guys starting out, Austin Idol and everything else. But this guy, David Woods, I think screwed up the whole thing, the whole works, where all this stuff was going so great. And not to forget Paul Lee Dangerously as well. So, yeah, it was great to be around. Great stuff. And then you went back to, and it's no offense, these guys had their day in wrestling, but then you're going back to like Bob Armstrong and whatnot, who was way washed up by then, and you'd have to start watching that stuff again, where he just had the thing popping and it wasn't appreciated, and the money stopped, and you know, there's all those other problems. And you know, there's a lot of people in wrestling that get in there that shouldn't be, or don't know when to get out of the way, and that's my opinion.
And really, well, the problem with Continental before Eddie came in, it was not the quality of the talent, it was that you just had too many guys who homesteaded a small territory.
Yeah.
So it was very repetitive. I mean, nothing against the I mean, you think of the quality of guys that were there. The Armstrongs, Tom Pritchard, mm-hmm. you know, Nightmares, Fullers / Goldens, great, great workers, but most of them had been there for way too long.
Right, and it was almost like what's going on now. Please don't shoot me for saying that, but kind of what you're saying is where the guys in WWE don't have anywhere else to go. Yeah. So you're seeing the same thing over and over and over.
That's a great point. Yeah, that's a great point.
And then you have these guys there, like you just said, where you're right, they were there forever, and how many different ways can you mix them and match them? But you know, and the thing I would say, believe me, it's no knock on the Armstrongs, because every one of them could work, except for which one was it? One of them I didn't really care for too much, but Bob, would by that point,
well, would that be the one who's currently a WWE road agent?
It could well be, or the one that was the referee, whichever. But
you didn't think Scott was a good worker?
I thought he was good, but he was just too small, I think.
Yeah. He was a little on the skinny side.
Yeah, but Bob, by that point, had no business being in the main event and being that over and being put over the guys that he was being put over. And it started to show that, that I guess that's what I was trying to say.
I mean, yeah, the Continental, it's a different era, you know, and those guys needed the break. And of course, a lot of those guys ended up going to, you know, USA, where it's Ron Fuller start up in Knoxville. Mm-hmm. And they brought that stuff up there. Although Robert Fuller and Jimmy Golden went to Memphis. So they took that stuff to Memphis. So basically, at one point, you had like three versions of Continental. You had Memphis doing Continental stuff.
Yeah, in 88.
You had USA doing Continental stuff, and you had Continental. Mm-hmm. So, which actually Continental was doing like Memphis stuff with Eddie. So it was a real interesting time period for the three territories.
And then Fuller or whoever else was booking, depending on the moment or which month you're talking about, would lift angles that had been on Continental TV a couple weeks earlier.
Yeah.
Several times throughout the year.
Yeah, so, yeah. Continental lasted for another full year before they eventually shut the doors altogether. But
with such great talent as lead manager Randy Hales.
Yeah, that was I love Continental though. That was
no, me too. I'm just saying it's
my all time favorite territories. But yeah, it was not what it once was. That's for sure. It wasn't 1985-86 Continental, but it was still fun. But moving on to Peach State of Florida. Yeah. The Sunshine State, and right
I thought
now,
for a second you were saying the Peach State of Florida, and I got very confused.
The Sunshine State of Florida, as FCW is up and running, Mike Graham's promotion. Jimmy Backlund, the future Jimmy Del Rey, defeated Tyree Pride for the FCW Light Heavyweight title on December the 10th in Tampa. I would probably think that would be at the Sportatorium. I don't think they would run the Armory anymore, but...
Yeah, and let me, you know, and there's a reason why that was in Tampa. That wouldn't have happened in Miami. just because of the, basically when Tyree had a match, a lot of times they talked about, a few people had a joke about there being a Haitian death match up in the stands in the general admission when he had matches or was getting heat or whatever. So he had quite the ego, but he really was over with those with his people, as he called them. But that's why it would be in Tampa and not Miami. They would lose a belt.
Yeah, you always would. I always read about Tyree Pride and in the aftermags. You know, he was always around as a champion or something, Bahamas champion or something. Mm-hmm. But you never saw footage of him. It was like very rare.
Yeah, and there's a reason for that. he was a small guy. He could get in the air okay, but not great. Had the ego twice as big as his body. And, you know, he's not one of the most well-liked guys in wrestling. Now, I didn't have a problem with him outside of the time he was at a small indie TV taping and he thought I was laughing at him or something. And then he also wanted me to work TV and put a hood on. But I'm not joking either. But he said it to me and I hadn't been completely trained. And I said, you know, I knew better and I'm respectful enough to sit there and say, look, I don't want to hurt anybody and, you know, I don't want to get hurt either. But I was also this thing was so small that I was actually doing TV commentary.
Yeah.
So I'm like, let me see. So you're going to go out there and do a squash match. You won't have a color commentator or, you know, whatever the heck we were doing back then. Cause you know, we just got thrown in there at the last second cause some people didn't show up. So it was pretty funny.
Indie wrestling, everyone.
So he wanted you to do the Mike Lano with the, Gordon Scazzari taping type of thing.
Not exactly,
but close
I don't
enough.
Think it had anything to do with, you know, taking pictures and having every one of them come out blurry and then grabbing other people's pictures and trying to claim their mine and, you know, and being completely complete whack job. I'm close, but, you know.
Well, what he did was that he was taking pictures at the whole taping. Then he had arranged for something where when Sabu worked.
I had seen something like that.
He came out like dressed like with the like just with the thing on his head and talked like the Grand Wizard doing running commentary on the house mic the whole match, and then he just took it off and went back taking pictures.
And the question is though, did he actually approve that with anybody, or he just do it? Was the approval conversation something that he had in his own head, or
Gordon Scazzari, so like I'm just gonna assume that he somehow obtained permission, just because the whole thing was just so haphazard.
One of these days, I'm gonna have to get Bob Barnett and people like you, Pete, and show old Mike Lano.
You mean like the show I did with Brian and Bob, like? God, what was that, 8 years ago? I don't know.
Just a show of Mike Lano. I mean, God. There's so many stories about that guy and all them.
But there are more stories, so yeah. I mean,
yeah, there are more stories. You know, some people breaking the business by being a ring rat. Some people breaking the business by, you know, picking the guys up and maybe or maybe not doing stuff, bringing them drugs, whatever it might be. Some guys give them free dental care. You know, just.
Oh, Dr. Mike. Oh, man. Anyway, I digress. And we go We go back to Memphis. We talked about Memphis earlier.
Our favorite territory.
Yeah, yep. And Sid Vicious, who was mentioned earlier in the show, beat Brian Lee on WMC television on December 10th to become the new CWA heavyweight champion using a loaded knee brace.
Because if there's a wrestler who should do a loaded whatever gimmick, it's Sid.
And this is Sid, like, very new working as himself and not Humongous.
I think this is the first one he ever worked as Sid Vicious, right?
Yeah, and it was a few days later when he worked against Kerry in the Sportatorium.
That's right. Oh, that's right, which was on TV. Which was on Flash TV. That was,
exactly, yeah.
Now, I'm trying to remember, when relative to this was the angle where he breaks Jamie Dundee's neck? Like a month or two before?
Yeah.
That was a month or two before this. Yeah.
But Pete, you know, Sid Vicious was a guy. I mean, you could just look at him and you knew that wrestling promoters were going to be drooling over wanting to push this guy. And they were for years.
Yeah. And, quick, funny story there. One of the tapings I went to, for Continental, what happened was Sid was back there as Humongous, and it's before the tapings, and I hadn't met him yet, and I'm walking around and whatnot, and he's back there without the hood on, and Missy's back there talking to him, and she had rollers in her hair because it's before the taping, you know.
Yeah.
And he saw me and he starts growling at me. It was like one of the funniest things ever. I guess you had to be there, but
that's the least surprising story I've ever heard about a professional wrestler.
Exactly.
For more stories on Sid, read Downtown Bruno's book.
Yeah. There you go. Yep.
But yeah, Sid was a guy. I mean, as I said, he was going to be privileged no matter what in the business because of his size.
Sure.
I mean, he is wrestling privilege to the T.
And he was a good athlete.
I mean, he could do things, but...
He never really parlayed it into being a good pro wrestler, but he was a really good athlete for his size.
Yeah, he was probably at his best in this run. And in this era of Sid, but I guess before he started believing his own height, He was actually pretty good.
But if you said when he went back to Memphis, though, he would kind of regain the sparkle.
Yeah, when he was in Memphis, he always performed good.
It was home, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, I guess, more motivated there.
Could play softball on his off days.
That's right. Softball Sid.
Now,
that's why I thought instead of the knee brace gimmick, maybe he'd have a baseball bat gimmick, but go ahead.
Squeegee gimmick. And Brian Lee's another guy who, you know, we've talked about before on other shows.
Well, we've talked about his cousins on shows lately.
Yeah, and I talked about him on the Smoky Mountain Exile show, but Brian Lee's a guy who had another great look, but never could put it together, you know, on a big stage.
Well, I'm sure there were various good reasons for that.
Well, but still, I mean,
there was something about, like, negative charisma.
Yeah.
Although he was much better as a heel. Definitely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, especially Smoky Mountain when he was hooked up with Tammy.
Mm.
Again, that's a whole nother show. Back to Memphis. On December the 12th, 1988, at Mid-South Coliseum, we mentioned, alluded to this earlier, in front of 1,400 fans, so a bad house, we had Tracy Smothers over Mike Davis, IWGP Heavyweight title match, Tatsumi Fujinami in the second match, defending against Tommy Lane.
Now, how much time did Tommy Lane have left before he just disappeared?
This was like a few months before that happened.
Did he ever resurface?
I don't think so.
That's weird. Wrestling. I mean, he just vanished, right? I mean,
yeah, pretty much.
I mean, did he give notice to where he was working at least?
No, because you know, he was replaced by Alan Martin, who will become Kevin Dillinger. his RPM character, but another great Continental jobber. But
and a great manager in Continental when Eddie Gilbert was booking.
Yeah, exactly.
Mr. Alan Martin.
And another one that again adds that list to the people that were never more over than when Eddie was booking him in Continental.
Exactly. But yeah, Fujinami in the second match on the show against Tommy Lane in a title match. CWA heavyweight title. Brian Lee defeated Sid Vicious by DQ. Beauty and the Beast, our good friend Terry Garvin, Sims, and Mark Guline over Jeff Jarrett and Scott Steiner. That's right, young
Scott. What a match that is.
Yeah. And Wendell Cooley and Bill Dundee over Robert Fuller and Jimmy Golden.
Speaking of Continental guys going to Memphis. Yep.
And your main event, Jerry Lawler successfully defending the AWA heavyweight title against Kamala. So there's your day before Superclash show at the Mid-South Coliseum, because yes, Superclash was a pay-per-view on a Tuesday.
Why?
I'm just thinking about that plane ride.
Oh, you God, yeah.
Think of who's involved here. Would we be shocked if it wasn't a bus? If it was a bus?
Not at all.
Well, Robert Fuller could have whipped it out. They could all rode up there with him on this.
Yeah. Oh, one big crying out loud. Do we really have to talk about Jumbo? That Jumbo. I'd love to talk about the other Jumbo.
The stories are true, folks. If you go to my Twitter feed, I will retweet that picture.
Jamie Dundee loved to talk about in a Shun interview how Robert Fuller nicknamed it Jumbo.
I don't think it took off on house shows, that's for sure.
Yeah, but it didn't like to take bumps when it was cold either.
Yeah, no nights off for that Jumbo, that's for sure. I wonder what happened to Sylvia. You know, that's a definite one.
They got divorced, right?
Yeah, they got divorced. Not too long, the year after this, like not going into 90, yeah.
It was around, like right after the angle where they split, right?
Yeah, yeah. Amazing how that worked out, huh?
Yeah, pro wrestling, huh?
Oh, Sylvia. Oh, me. All right, going to the Pacific Northwest, Don Owen has given up his television in Seattle voluntarily due to not being able to make the payments.
Okay, wait, I have to interrupt you for a second. So I guess that means that they had lost the PBS station years earlier.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you know when that happened, when they lost the PBS?
I have no idea. No,
yes, they were the only territory that was on public television at least in a major market, right?
Yeah.
Which is crazy because that was their best drawing city and they didn't have any localized promos.
I know. That was crazy. And this is also the time period where there was a big time deal that happened with Matt Bourne, where there was something involving blood where they almost got banned. So I think that may have part of it too.
They had at least, if not banned blood, then at least started to crack down, I think, the commission.
Yeah, because there was some serious deal going on with that.
Well, they were very like, you know, hey, there's this AIDS thing.
Yeah.
In Oregon, and this is really, I guess, the beginning then of the commission issues that Oregon became notorious for, right?
Exactly, exactly, yeah. Now, Matt Bourne and Scott Peterson did an interesting gimmick on December the 6th in Hokium, Washington, as they went to a draw, and Peterson wanted 5 more minutes, but Bourne said that he wouldn't do it unless the fans pay for it, so they passed the hat around the crowd and raised $250, mainly because one guy threw in $200. And they did the rematch with Peterson winning the money. Now, Dave Meltzer said that there is something about that gimmick that rubs him the wrong way. And the reason why I include this in is, yeah, it started on December the 6th, but they started doing it around the horn at every show. So, yeah, they were getting extra money, folks.
Well, it reminds me of a couple things. In a way, it sort of reminds me of the the great lucha matches where the fans throw money. But nowadays, especially if it's the older wrestlers, they kind of have to try to encourage the fans to do it.
Go ahead.
They don't ask them to do it like this. I mean, they're not passing a hat around.
Well, no, they're not passing a hat around. But I know, like when they like when they had Negro Navarro and Solar in Philly, wasn't there a thing where like they tried to guilt the fans into giving them money?
It wasn't the talent that was doing it; it was other fans.
No, I know, and then also the gimmick in Europe where the babyface would get the public warning and the fine, and then the fan would offer to pay it for the babyface.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, then you had to work them, but this is totally different. This is like the the church passed an offering plate around. There wasn't enough money in there already, so they passed it around again to make sure that they get what they need. So that's
no, it's not nearly as clever as the Europe thing.
No. Now, Matt Bourne, Pete's a guy who had so much going on for him, but wow, was he a nutcase outside the ring.
Yeah, what talent. Yeah, I remember even back, I know you guys will remember too, that thing where he was in Georgia and then all of a sudden gone, what they were doing. It was right when that's how the Road Warriors started, right?
Exactly. Right. Him and Arn Anderson were supposed to be the national tag team champions. Then he has a, let's just say, a situation in a hotel room.
Which I think we've talked about numerous times.
Yeah, it gets fired, and then Ole has to create a new tag team. And there it's Animal and Hawk.
Right, and that's like one of those subjects that you don't want me to start going off on because you'll get like a long rant. The short version is I think that was the beginning of a really bad place for wrestling where you started taking guys that were bouncers and stuff like that and putting them in untrained. And you started a whole
wave of that. I thought
you
were going
to
start talking about Matt Bourne.
Matt Bourne, real quick, great talent, screwed up head, son of a wrestler. What can you say? But yeah. Seriously, though, it's just terrible waste of talent.
Exactly. Now, on December the 10th in Portland, Top Gun, David Sierra, the human assassin.
The other human assassin.
Yeah, defeated Buddy Rose in a hair versus hair match. And Buddy was shaved bald. But the main event of this show was the grappler, Lynn Denton, regaining the Northwest Heavyweight title by defeating Tatsumi Fujinami after kicking him in the balls with his loaded boot in what was said to have been a great match. This is the Tatsumi Fujinami show, folks. I mean, he's everywhere. He's like Elvis in the Mojo Nixon song. He is everywhere.
Now I really want to see that match.
I know. I want to see both these matches. I want to see Top Gun and Buddy Rose.
Well, I guess it's possible to air it on TV, right?
Yeah, but really there's not a lot of the, PNW stuff from that era.
88 is a big blind spot, right? I mean, that's one of the bigger ones that we have.
I think there is a certain tape dealer in New York that's not the one that we talked about before, but another certain tape dealer in New York who's retired that has this stuff. But
wait, who would that? Okay.
You want initials?
Sure.
CW.
Oh, okay. Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I think he has stuff in this era, but yeah, other than that, I've never seen it on anybody's list. So, yeah, I mean, I would have loved to see this type of stuff. But Buddy Rose, another guy. Another great talent.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Yeah. And amazing that he stayed there for so long. You talk about homesteading. And he had that push in the WWF, a little bit. If I remember right, he didn't get his world title match in the Garden.
He got everywhere else.
He did get in the garden. It was just one-off.
He did get one in MSG. I think he got one at the Spectrum. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't get it all the way around, but he did get shots at Backlund, no doubt. And
yeah, well, definitely.
He also he had that run in Florida too in '85. And for a few months, so he worked around. But
it was another one of those. He might have been one of the few that beat Tyree for the Bahamas title.
Yeah.
Maybe in the Bahamas or Miami. I don't, remember exactly, but it's probably right.
Right. He was the Bahamas champion, correct.
And he had that run with the AWA, the tag team titles and all that, and then just ballooned at the end of, pretty much the end of his life, right?
Yeah. Became a joke in WWF, the blowaway die and all that stuff. But
work then, though.
Yeah, but it wasn't like he was a few years earlier. He's a fantastic one. Now, Don Owen has competition. Now, this has been a tough year for Don Owen. Billy Jack Haynes has started the OWF as competition for him. They went under. And now you got this guy, Mal Saracino, who's up at the PCWA, Pacific Coast Wrestling Association. And he runs a show the same night as the Portland show in Oregon City in front of 250 fans with Brian Adams That's right, Crush. And Mike Miller going over Coco Samoa and Tiger Chung Lee by DQ in the main event.
So Tiger Chung Lee was in Oregon?
Yes, he worked for Billy Jack Haynes.
I didn't know. So, but had he been living there and just not working, or
no, he'd been working for Billy Jack Haynes, and when the OWF closed up, you know, I guess he went to work for this Saracino.
No, but where
dude.
Was he working before the OWF?
Who knows?
Like, I know he did Mid-Atlantic, but that's long, long before.
He did WWF jobs.
Well, I'm trying to remember, when he finished up with WWF.
So he would have been WWF in 87, at least, I know of. So.
Right. And one of the things I love about the OWF, or maybe the thing to love about the OWF, is didn't Billy Jack Haynes act in the newspapers that he was part of the Oregon Wrestling Federation name, and him having just left WWF, didn't he act like WWF wrestlers were going to come in? Or outright say it.
If I remember right, it was an allusion to that. But, of course, it didn't happen. But, yeah, it was an allusion to that. And really, but, yeah, that one was an interesting one. You know, whenever we do that show, whenever that week comes up, you know, and that whole deal started, Don Owen took that hard because Billy Jack was one of his main guys for years. Yep. And he just, I don't even know why he went against Don Owen. If I remember,
why
there wasn't
Billy Jack Haynes do anything?
Yeah, good point. And Pete, that's a guy who you definitely remember in Florida. Oh my God, was he over there? I mean, he's another guy, though, you could say that Dusty might have put the kibosh on, too.
Well, what was interesting was when the first time he went to the WWF, I want to go with 2 weeks later. I go into Miami and they're handing out flyers saying that Billy Jack's wrestling Flair next week for the world title. And I'm like, isn't he in the WWF?
We talked about this two weeks ago.
You know what? Yeah. Oh, okay. There you go. And I was talking
about saying it all comes to the same thing. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. And they, you know, and that's long ago. That's in the, you know, mid 80s, right?
84, 80, 84.
83, 80, yeah, there you go, 84. That's I figured 83 or 85, I was going to say. So I should have taken the middle. But even then, look, think about that. That's over 30 years ago. And it wasn't like he was in the business that long at that point. Yet he WWF, what was he there for, like a week or something? And they had put
he worked
the big
two shows, I think.
Yeah, and he had the big push and whatnot, and it was all over TV. And then all of a sudden, he's back in Florida, and yeah, he was over like $1 million, and you know, they did all the publicity stuff and whatnot, and you could see he was going to have a huge career too. And then, you know, hey, obviously this man has his demons.
No, I'll say. Moving on to Potpourri, and this is one that Bix likes. FNN and Score has placed all wrestling programming on hiatus until further notice. Now Bix, tell everyone what all was on FNN Score in 1988.
At this point, I mean, I know you had Memphis, including the Score match of the week, which was a house show match.
Yes.
Usually a main event quality match.
Yes.
Continental for a while, mostly when Eddie was booking.
Yes.
Trying to remember what else.
Did they have Hawaii at times?
I think that was done by this point.
And also, Women?
No, that was Tempo. Because people
Tempo, that's
people
right.
Confuse FNN Score and Tempo because both got bought by NBC as part of the CNBC thing.
That's right. They combined them up, didn't they?
Yeah, because it was like they bought Tempo just to have something because Tempo was in a lot of homes. And then eventually, because FNN Score lasted a few more years, but they're the main competitor, so they bought FNN Score. Because FNN was Financial News Network, but Score was their, like, weekend and evening sports thing, and yeah. But they had aired all sorts of wrestling for years. I mean, I think, because I know Tempo had Savoldi ICW, but I think FNN Score might have too. They'd air other stuff. They'd do specials,
Pro
Wrestling This Week was on Score?
Yes, if I remember right, yeah.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that. I don't remember.
In 88, I think it was on there.
After it was done with like nationwide syndication, I guess.
I think so, yeah.
And but I feel like there's more we're forgetting, though.
I think so too.
And Tempo also had Power Pro Wrestling for Watts. They had Southwest and then the Texas Championship Wrestling Show.
You're making me feel better because I thought I was the only one watching it.
I know, as young as I was, I remember seeing the Tempo All Japan Women shows.
Awesome.
See, I never had those channels, so I missed out on that stuff.
And you'd go through and, you know, accidentally, you'd sit there and find stuff on that FNN score thing. And it was late night for quite often because they'd have other stuff on during the regular part of the day.
Well, right, because the Hawaii stuff, at least originally, like, I don't know if Score existed at first or what, like, it aired on FNN with the ticker.
Yeah, yes. that's what I was talking about, yeah.
So you can see your stocks and watch Lars Anderson milk Leah Maivia out of all her money.
And Farmer Boy Ippo matches, of course.
And a fake Leroy Brown.
There you go.
Well, is it a fake Leroy Brown if he's not really pretending to be the other? Like, are we really supposed to think that this Samoan guy is the same Leroy Brown?
Or maybe he was. Maybe he was the one from the Croce song. You never know.
Maybe. Well, moving on to World Class Championship Wrestling on December 9th at the Sportatorium, Eric Embry shot an angle with Scandal at Bar where he asked him if the $5,000 signing bonus for joining Devastation Incorporated was still on the table, which Akbar said no and that he didn't need his services anymore. Embry then basically begged and begged and begged Akbar, said he needs the money because he's going to lose everything in his life as he has become broke. Akbar relented and said he would give Embry $500. But Embry kept begging, so Akbar said okay, and he would give him the $5,000. So they made Akbar sign a contract, which Embry gave Frank Dusik. But the only problem was that Akbar signed a contract to wrestle Embry in an Anything Goes match on December 16th. Always love those type of angles. But yeah, this is the early part of the Eric Embry Akbar deal. And it spawned off of the earlier angle, which, you know, they're playing off of here, where Ak was recruiting Embry, but he wouldn't do it. And this is why Eric turned babyface and that whole deal. And, Pete, this revitalized World Class for, you know, maybe a six-month time period, a little bit more. But, I mean, that promotion, I mean, they had a pretty good year in 88 compared to the year and a half before. But
which is
this,
pretty amazing to say that the year in which they pretty almost went out of business because of losing money and all that was better than 87, but you're not
entirely wrong
either.
Yeah, but I mean, in 89, it really got, I mean, to being like must-see television in a lot of ways. It was one of the hottest television shows in wrestling. And Eric Embry's one of the main reasons for it. It was amazing to see that he had got himself over to a level like the Von Erichs.
And it's another, you would have never expected it. Like, you saw he had something, but to get to that level, and people rip on him all the time, but like you guys just said, hey, you know, results are results, and there you go.
And a lot of bookers have tried to get themselves over, and even though, but it doesn't always work. You got it to work. It doesn't usually work if you give yourself that big, just give yourself a big push. I mean, Eric Embry was a great worker. He had become a really good promo, and just something about him clicked.
Yeah.
Like, just, you can't even put your finger on it because some of it was just him having a weird it factor that worked in Dallas.
Exactly. And then, you know, you talk about going to the height of what you could do, like we were talking about with Eddie earlier, bringing guys there. I mean, Embry did it for himself, but he was over. There's no question.
And he got Phil Hickerson over big as in the PY Chu Hai gimmick, I mean, as ridiculous as it was.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was just amazing to watch. Yeah, that World Class stuff from 89, it's a really strong year all the way around. The Torch reported that Kevin Von Erich's concussion problems may force him to retire.
Well, it's not like he wrestled much around after this point anyway.
No, you know, Kevin was very sparse in wrestling. And, you know, I'm sure everybody probably thought, and rightly so, that it was, you know, mainly a drug situation. But this is like the first I've ever read of him having the concussion issues.
Really? I mean, he's talked about it.
Well, I mean, read in a newsletter.
Okay, yeah.
Because I don't think Dave ever really mentioned it. I don't remember seeing the Observer. So, and I'm reading these old torches for the first time. So yeah, that's like the first time I've ever seen that referenced.
I'm not sure.
But yeah, I mean, you watch World Class, Pete, from the '80s and stuff, and Kevin's talked about this. They treated their matches like real fights out there, pretty much. You could probably see where he would get concussions, but they were, I mean, laying up all them shots in hard and heavy.
Well, you know, getting them or giving them, one of the two. You know,
exactly.
Concussions. But he, you see, what bothers me here is it's the torch he ported it. The Observer, you never saw it. Could it have been that a Wade Keller exclusive that he spoke to someone who told him that, maybe Kevin even, you know, the old Von Erich thing they perpetuate and reported it as fact? I mean, who knows? You know, it's – but certainly, yeah, the way that they – people talked about going in with him and, you know, just not having a fight for their lives, but – I always heard that he was the one that was the stiffest in the ring, but in a good way, you know, and in the drop kicks and stuff. So who knows?
Well, of course, there's the famously gross story of what he accidentally did to himself via Buddy Roberts' tooth, where he got the foot infection because he lodged the tooth in his foot and Buddy didn't brush his teeth ever.
Ugh. I mean, just imagine that. Oh, God.
Of all the wrestlers for that to happen with, too, you got to choose Buddy Roberts. The only wrestler I would have less wanted to have that happen with would be, like, who, Don Fargo? God rest his soul.
I'm sure Tommy Rich, you know, he is mousing, you know, seeing some days and nights. You better believe that.
Imagine if you gave him a low blow.
Oh, Lord. There's a Missy joke there somewhere, but we're not.
Oh, man. And now we go to the World Wrestling Federation, and this is probably the slimmest section we'll ever have on them, as they had all their major TV tapings a day or two before this week's started that we're doing.
And we talked about their major act of sabotage already.
Yeah, we are talking about their major act of sabotage, but interesting note here is a bunch of protesters in Long Island forced a hearing on December the 13th with the New York Office of Consumer Protection over the loss of the MSG network on Cablevision. The office, though, is virtually powerless to enforce the changes needed.
Now, of course, the kicker on this...
Yes...
was that the lead protester, as named in Matt Watch, is the guy who we got a lot of these Matt Watches from, including this one.
Yes, exactly. But
Of course, on top of that, who owns Madison Square Garden now?
Cablevision.
Exactly.
And MSG Network was the only way you could watch the Garden shows, so of course there was a lot of people upset that they couldn't see WWF. And, you know, this is in December, so no New York Knicks. No New York Rangers. So, yeah, I mean, that's a pretty big deal to lose that network in that area.
Yeah.
And, Bix, you would know that area better than I would. So, I mean, talk about what the impact would be of not having an MSG network.
I mean, I'm trying to think back as far as the era, because you also had Sports Channel.
Yes.
And I think because I know maybe later, but my recollection is that I think Sports Channel was the more... You know what? It might not have been Rangers. It might have been Islanders. Because we have the two teams. So, yeah, I mean, I guess it would primarily be Rangers. And, I mean, you might have also had some baseball, too. I'm trying to remember exactly. Like, if it would have been Mets or Yankees. So,
It would have been Yankees because Mets is on Sports Channel.
That's right. So, yeah, I mean, it would have been a lot. And, you know, Cablevision... I don't know if I guess it's different now after they started, like, kind of investing in technology and stuff. Cablevision was pretty much almost universally considered the worst cable company in the area, if not the country. Like, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and to this day, there's, like, still problems with people I know have with it.
I mean, you'd hear about it. You know what I mean? It's, like, not, like, I don't know how it spread so much, but... Like, I even remember seeing an episode of Everybody Loves Raymond once where he's complaining about the cable company, although he doesn't name them. But, of course, the show takes place on Long Island with him as a writer at Newsday, I believe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just very, just the, you know, slim channel selection for a long time, just weird pricing. Like, I think for a long time, like, they kept certain things like Disney Channel or whatever as a premium channel when it stopped being one, or one of the things they did. I mean, they still might actually, is that for a while, because I have Fios now, they would. Like, you had to pay extra to get HBO On Demand and Showtime On Demand, even if you already had the primary, that network. Just stupid stuff. So, yeah, I mean, they were never well-liked, and this just adds to it. Of course, oh, and of course, they were the first cable company in the country to drop, or in North America, I think, even, to drop UFC and MMA in general. They were the last, I believe, the last big holdout for ECW. So, and wrestling fans generally did not care much for them.
Oh, yeah. They definitely watched ECW shows from New York. There was a lot of anti-Cablevision rhetoric being speared among the fans at the old Manhattan Center. But,
and, of course, I guess the thing with the campaign for the shows on MSG Network, or MSG Network coming back, it almost makes me think of it as like a proto strictly ECW or New Yorkers for ECW led by Tony Lewis.
Yeah, exactly. Now, one other thing that was going on at WF at the time, in fact, this week, I mean, as I said, there's not a lot of stories going on, but the house shows that are going on are being headlined, the A shows, by Hogan and Boss Man. And Pete, me and Biggs have talked about this on this show a lot, but Boss Man is one of Hogan's all-time great opponents, and nobody really talks about. But, I mean, they had great matches together. They popped big-time houses together, which is, you know, really interesting considering, you know, Boss Man over other, you know, guys that had more of a name than he did. But what did you think of the Hogan-Boss Man feud?
He's one of those guys I think was really underrated, and I think you just spoke about a lot of the reasons why. But to me, this was a guy that was big. Well, I guess that's why he has the name, but all seriousness.
It's the boss, and man, is he big.
Yeah, exactly. But on top of that, the guy could work, and he could bump around, and he had a personality and had a gimmick that was over. So, you know, what's not to like outside of, okay, maybe the guy was had a little weight on him or something like that, but I don't think that they had a lot of guys that had that whole package, that had that size that could bump like that. Oh, especially when you went with Hogan. I mean, yeah, maybe back for WWF you go all the way, and it's irrelevant probably, but, you know, with Bruno and stuff, you'd bring whoever in, but this guy could work, and he was big, and he wasn't like a lot of the guys they had one or the other, but not both. So, and I, for some reason, that gimmick, for, and I'm not talking about myself or, you know, hardcore fans preference, but that gimmick never really got old. For whatever reason, it seemed that gimmick was over no matter what, babyface or heel. And maybe it had something to do with them switching him back and forth enough, you know, in a good way, because I think it was over either direction.
And isn't it funny how, you know, when he did all the different gimmicks after the fact in WCW, he never was as over as he was as the Boss Man.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a point. And they tried to do that knockoff thing of it with the, I forgot what they even called it, but the thing.
The Guardian Angel.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
And back the Big Bubba and Ray Trailer, the biker, and stuff like that. I mean, they had him as the boss, you know, when he first came in WCW, and it was over. The fans were into him, but they, of course, had to switch that up. But
yeah, probably, yeah, from a little legal letter or something.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, that could have been.
From my good friend Jerry McDevitt.
Yes. Dun, dun, dun. But, yeah, Ray Trailer, you know, a true gem in wrestling.
I mean, really, I mean, just such a... And one of the things, you know, just such a great worker. And also, I mean, he was, I guess you would say he was the first, like, super heavyweight in WWF or WWF that really got to be like your big bumping heel, because for a long time that was just not the way they did things. Like your super heavyweight or your giants were more like, you know, guys for other guys to pinball off of.
John Studd.
Exactly.
Bundy could do some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Bundy was not bad, but
he then got bigger though when he was there.
No, and also it was like, wasn't that kind of a WWF philosophy?
Yeah.
That they didn't want heels who bumped a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the rings probably also had something to do with that.
I mean, yeah, you could probably say that. Well, on that note, we're going to close the show out. But first, before we, you know, really get into the plugs, you know, I mentioned earlier in the show that Pete was the former president of the Wrestling Fans International Association. And a lot of you people that listen to this show are probably in your late 20s, early 30s, maybe younger, maybe a little bit older. But you probably don't know how big that was. And Pete, I mean, you know, I reading all these old newsletters that I've read from Jason Campbell at ProWrestlingIssue.com, the WFIA had a big presence in wrestling for many years, and you would have the yearly get-togethers in all the major cities, and part of angles on television, you know, of course the Gilbert Rich deal. But yeah, talk about your days in the WFIA and like some of the good times you had.
Well, it was the forerunner for a lot of the stuff that you see now. I was talking to you earlier off the air, I guess, about the Greg Price conventions that they do. And you see a lot of the other people do varying things. But back then, you didn't have that. You didn't have the internet, phone stuff. Heck, you didn't have cell phones, if anybody can imagine that. But what people did, you'd correspond with people. You'd write to people through the mail. If there was results to go over, you'd find some other hardcore fans. And where would you find them? And, you know, it was sort of a stigma to be to admit to that. So this was the annual gathering of that, and we'd work with different promotions, and it got started in the 1960s. Of course, I did too. I was born in 1961, but I started going in 1978, believe in Knoxville. And then in 79 was my first exposure to Memphis. And that's actually the first time almost everybody saw the Fabulous Freebirds. That was when Hayes and Gordy debuted in Memphis at Mid-South Coliseum, which was really weird because I remember they lost to Lawler and Dundee, I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
Okay. So that was a little strange, but one of my favorite memories there, you know, you had all kinds of people and wrestling fans, and it could be – they'd be varying degrees of involved in the business. It's where I met Eddie Gilbert and Jim Cornette before they broke in the business. Give you an idea. As well, you got to meet the guys that were in the business at the time, and from going from one promotion to another, you'd see stuff that you usually wouldn't get the opportunity to, and you'd meet people from all over the country, and that was at a time where it cost a lot to fly, relatively speaking, and you didn't have the communication that you had, so this is the time where you would meet all these other people that were involved, like you were, as a fan, and then meet people involved in the business as well. The year after 79 was 1980. I know that's an interesting fact, but it was in Atlanta. And the crazy thing was I was in the stands. That was the big turn when and I was actually there. And a bunch of people remember this. I'm not putting myself over. This is just a well-known secret. But that's Killer Carl Cox line, by the way. I said when right before that match started, how great would it be if they all jumped Dusty in the cage? And sure enough, that's what happened. But that happened to be the week of the convention. Now, whether they did that because we're there or not, I don't think so. I think it just happened to be that week, but that I wasn't privy to. Once we got into a couple years later, I believe they went to Indianapolis after that. And then I don't remember.
Why would you go to Indianapolis in that era for a WFIA convention?
To quote one of my other idols, Billy Joel, don't ask me why. my guess is that it's possible maybe they were in – somebody was in good with Dick the Bruiser. Mike Gratchner was running the WFIA at one point. I'm not sure where the transition went back to Don Wilson, but Mike was from Illinois, so – maybe it had something to do with that. I really don't know, but I'm pretty sure they went to Indianapolis and then went to Houston.
Yep.
And then went back to Memphis in 1983. And I went back there, and that's where things really snowballed for me as far as it went. Don Wilson was the founder of the WFIA, and he and Dave Brzezinski, Dave Drayson, you know, Supermouth, those guys were there. And there was a bit of fragmenting going on. The guys, Don and Dave, kept the thing going, and they wanted to get out. And I won Fan of the Year that year for whatever reason. We talked about it, and I decided to take it over. And my friend Howard Baum at the time was there as well. And I was just going back to college at the time and whatnot. So I was like, well, you know, he has connections with certain legs. I do. So, you know, it'd be better to work together. But what happened was, some of the other people wound up supporting a guy named Jim Ross. And please don't confuse it with good old JR, because this is a different guy. My thing was, I loved doing it. So I loved having these get-togethers. This other guy, and unfortunately a lot of the original people went with him. And it's not about me versus him. It's about what happened. This guy took out ads in the Pro Wrestling Illustrated and all these other things, paid a lot of money. And to me, it was about the enjoyment and the fun and seeing all the people. And I don't know if he was trying to create a business model. I'm not really sure. But the people that did go with him got stabbed in the back. And the first year we did it, when Howard and I ran it, is where we had that whole Eddie Gilbert and Tommy Rich angle that you guys have heard about. And that came from – I was in school in Tallahassee, Florida, and I would go to Memphis every so often. You know, it was a pretty good drive, but I loved it. And we'd go hang out and, you know, promote the thing and do all that. And I was on the Jerry Lawler show the week before the convention that year. And the thing was, Lawler's show was taped right after Memphis TV. The TV was live on Saturday. There was like an hour break, and then we would tape the Lawler show. So I was on the Lawler show on that Sunday before the convention. But who else is on it but Eddie Gilbert? And Eddie and I had time to just sit there in the studio by ourselves talking, and Lawler was busy with some other things and people that I taught the Bix about at one point, but I won't repeat right now. But but nonetheless, Eddie and I were talking about it, and Eddie had been a member of the WFIA, and he and I knew each other forever. And I said, you know, hey, why don't we do this? And, you know, we'll come in like we don't know what's going on, or we kind of have a little idea, but not much. And you guys have wrote Tag Team of the Year, and on and on and on. And we talked about it. He loved it, thought it through. He gave it to Jerry Jarrett during the week, and he told me it was a go, I think on Thursday or Friday night. I don't remember. And I knew what was, you know, so what was really cool was, first of all, I never told Howard anything. I just told him that we were just going out there because that's what they said to do. Because, you know, people could be the best actors in the world, but you want a more natural reaction. So my thing was, anytime I went on TV out there, I was between being like, okay, trying to be professional, but not coming off like this 22-year-old kid that's running this international organization, which was the case. Okay.
Yeah.
But by the same token, I didn't want to talk in a way that I wanted to – I didn't want to appear arrogant either, and especially in the Deep South. So I kind of was always watching what I said and whatnot. But anyway, the really cool thing was just seeing your idea come to life. And, you know, Eddie, of course, you know, he did a lot of it. And it was just my original idea. And we talked it over and whatnot. And, you know, they embellished it and whatnot. But that it was just one of the coolest things ever, pretty much. But Lance Russell couldn't have been nicer. Lawler and Eddie Gilbert, you know, there was my three linchpins right there. And it was so great. We just brought it back there the next year. I couldn't imagine it being better. In the meantime, in between that first and second year, that Jim Ross guy sent the Memphis promotion a threatening legal letter because he was trying to claim ownership of the Wrestling Fans International Association name. And I'm going like, oh my God, you know, and you know, I got it from the guy who owned it and, you know, was the originator, all this other stuff. But of course, being, let's just say, I was going to say wrestling, but it's not really, it's more like the lawyer mentality. Dude had the thing sent to the promotion probably a couple days before our convention was supposed to start. So what I told them was, you know what we'll do? Just call it Wrestling Fans International instead of International Association. And by that point, I was like, you know what? If this guy wants to you know, put all this money into it, I don't have the time or money to do that. I want this thing to continue. If he's putting that much money into it, maybe he'll keep it continuing. A few people I knew kind of were going along with the idea. So I'm like, okay, you know, so I've been wrong before. And I actually closed up my little shop because, you know, I was in the middle of college anyway. So I said, hey, you know, why don't you guys throw your support to this guy? He seems like, you know, he's doing this stuff or whatever. My whole goal, and honestly it was for that stuff to continue so people would still have it. And sure enough, that didn't last probably about a year or two maybe. And that was the end of the WFIA.
Now, one question I've always had, and, you know, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but regarding the awards, mm-hmm. It was always convenient that the awards were always handed out to everybody that was in that territory. And kind of, I don't know, it just made it look weird, I guess you could say. What were your thoughts about that?
Well, back then, it wasn't a situation where there was the as much cable and, you know, especially going back in the 60s, but as much internet, which was done. But the thing is that you're there and it's sort of a closed, not closed shop, but the people that would see it were really only the local people.
Yeah,
it wasn't like, yeah, there was tape trading going on. And, you know, especially towards the end, there was a lot more of it. But we actually did something that, you know, we would do things just as a little rib and made some people laugh, like Lawler was cracking up. You know, we had the really archaic stuff, you know, the VHS and the beta and whatnot. And we actually did it one time where the tag team nominees, we actually did nominees and we showed it at the banquet and we did the video. And I don't know if you ever saw the video, and we're going in either it was 84 or 85, I forget which year it was. And the video where they did of Lawler, Jerry Jarrett and Tojo.
Yes.
Okay.
And with the real farm.
Yep. With the real soul music and stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
So we showed one of the Fabulous Ones videos, the Rock and Roll Express, Jarrett and Tojo and the Road Warriors. you know, and you saw like everybody cried, like the people who got what we were doing cracking up. And then you had the local Memphis people were going like, that's right, there's my boys, Jarrett and Tojo. So, you know, we did what you did. But that, the, as far as the guys being local, though, that's the deal. It wasn't like stuff was going out nationally outside of in the magazines. Really, that was only the wrestling news, right? As far as which ones who would cover it. So we never got any flack about that.
It always just seemed like, okay, I see the deal here. WFI, like I said, it was a big deal in newsletters and stuff because that community was always, you know, there, you know, whether it was in the, you know, Terry Justice's newsletters or anybody else that had newsletters at that time period, Joe Shedlock and people like that. You always see the WFIA always around.
Yeah, Terry was actually at that one in, I believe he was there in 78 as well. And the 79, you know, obviously with Eddie, but that's where he,
we vaguely talked about that a little bit.
I think you told me the best word. Well, the best word to use would be man crush.
Okay, let's go with that.
But there was some stuff going on there. But still though, dude put out some great.
Oh my God! Yes, he did, and truly, when you look, the poor guy passed away when he was driving the wrestling team.
I know.
So in a car accident. So, you know, and he loved wrestling, and you know, he did a lot to promote it, which was that was the thing back with those guys and the WFIA people. It was about that. It wasn't necessarily about them making money. It was about promoting their love for something and something they were passionate about. And it was the fans doing that. So, you know, a lot of the wrestlers loved it. I never really saw much of a backlash against it from the wrestling community either. Outside of, I get the one thing I did see was our second year, Tom Renesto, trying not to, you know, trying to kayfabe us a little bit, and we didn't go on TV that second year. But it had
Wasn't Dave there that year?
Dave
Meltzer was at these events too.
We were that was a fun one too, because I was like trying to make sure, because I knew Lawler had come out really strongly against Dave's bulletin, and then when Dave was there, you know, I was sort of like, you know, just keeping an eye on things a little bit.
Wow. Yeah.
This is Howard Baum's cousin.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what was the reason for Lawler coming out against Dave? What did Dave say something about Lawler or what?
No, it was just kayfabe. That was.
And
we were really, really careful about what we said, and as far as how many locals were in there, and what was done at what times and what was available to be seen. In other words, if there was a bunch of the local people there, maybe we didn't have like the observers out or something. I know Lance Russell gave like a really good talk, but he shut the doors to the meeting room, you know, that type of thing. So, but the people, you know, there were a few people that got their, you know, a little bit more educated from that. But, you know, you got to remember it was Memphis and the Deep South. And one of the beauties of all that was that a lot of people still really believed. So even when they were among all of us and whatnot, they still, like I said, hey, we showed that video with the fabulous ones, Rock and Roll Warriors and Tojo and Jarrett, and one of the locals were sitting there going, yeah, there's my boys, 100% serious. We were doing it as a little rib. So, so we didn't have that issue as far as that went, but I always found that kind of interesting, though. But that would be why with Lawler, though. It was just at the time, a lot of people in the business hated the Wrestling Observer. You got to remember, at the time, it was revolutionary And when you read through, even when you guys were reading some stuff from it earlier today, when you were talking about it, it was much more inside. Remember, there was no internet. It was funnier, you know, that type of thing. Think Dave was definitely far sharper. Less political.
Yeah, it's definitely sharper.
yeah. So there's a lot of reasons why they wouldn't want it to be seen. And then there were some that would never read it. And then it morphed into people. Everybody read it, but no one admitted to it. And now I'm not even sure what goes on. You know, I don't think it matters.
Well, now we have the Meltzer driver.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, now he has his own finishing move. Now, did you go to that one? Did you go to the one in Houston?
I didn't.
Okay,
I missed the two in 80 and – oh, no, 81 and 82. Those are the two I missed.
Because what I read from one of the newsletters, I can't remember which one, that had like the rundown of that event. They made it sound like that was like the best one ever. And then mainly because of Paul Bosch, how nice and how great Paul Bosch was. As a man, you know, how Paul Bosch like took care of them and, you know, I mean, made them feel like that they were extremely important. I mean, it goes to tell, I mean, everybody hears so much about Paul Bosch, you know, about what he was in the business. And I mean, yeah, he took care of a lot of wrestling fans that, you know, that weekend came from all over the world.
I mean, look what he did for Dave, all the things he did for Dave.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, just so many things, or even just. All the people he took in and got gave jobs, and you know, Tom Pritchard, Bruce Pritchard, you know, looked after Gino too, just everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, that's what Memphis was to us.
Yeah,
you know, but you know, it was they were good to everybody, but like I said, my three linchpins of Lance and Eddie and Lawler, you know. I had great relationships with all three. Still would. You know, unfortunately, Eddie's not here, and I still miss him every day. But you know, the other two, I still do. So, you know, but it wasn't the same. I guess Paul would have been with everybody, and those guys were with us. And you know, Lance was were going to everybody, I guess. And Eddie, of course, being a heel, you know, he could only do so much.
Yeah.
It was real classic, though. Just a real, I know you guys got to wrap it up, but right after that angle, Eddie, we went with Eddie to get something to eat, and Eddie had that notorious thing for driving. You know, like he got in a bunch of car accidents and stuff. And you should have seen the ladies look when we went into Burger King or wherever it was to get something to eat. And he was, you know, he had just gigged and all that and had all the bandages on and walked in with us, and you can only imagine if someone saw it on TV and that we were all going in there together. But you know, there you go. So just a little thing for you.
Yeah, definitely want to get some WFIA stories out there, so I'm definitely going to get that out. Yeah. And I guess that, I mean, you got anything else going on right now in the plug or what's
no,
going on for you?
That actually I've been, you know, with it being more of a closed shop, and I actually shot negatives when I did. So all I'm doing is, you know, I have a Facebook page, and, you know, you could just look it up under my name. And we have the Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives Facebook page. It used to be the website.
What a great site that was, too. Yep. Oh, man.
Have you guys gone to the Facebook page?
Yes.
I haven't. You got to send me a link later.
All right, I will. Yeah, you should, because it's I'll just add you or something, because that's what happened was we just – I don't know what happened with the bandwidth or the person who's running it, but Barry just transformed it over to a Facebook page now. And, you know, and I do have the photos on there. The quick Reader's Digest version is a Ruth Ullman shot photos from early 70s, maybe even 1970, I think 71 though. Up through the early 80s. My friend Brian Berkowitz shot from like the mid 70s to the early 80s as well. I started shooting in 87, and I got some negatives from Don Friedman as well that I bought, but I have them all scanned, cataloged and whatnot. And I still sell photos, but you know, that business is not my main thing. I'm a teacher, and That's one thing I've always done. It's not my main vocation, the photography. I used to say it used to support my wrestling photo collecting habit.
But
I still do that. So if anybody's interested, I do have a Facebook page for that as well. It's probably like Pete Lederberg's Wrestling Photos or something. And, you know, I work with magazines and things like that still. And that's pretty much it. Nothing really much to promote. Happy you guys had me on here, and I appreciate that. And anytime you need, just give me a shout.
Awesome, awesome. Bix, it's that time. Go ahead and get them out.
I don't know if there's even that much this week. Next Fighting Spirit article will be an article I wrote about Nick Bockwinkel. Talk to Zabisco, to Larry Hennig, to Baron von Raschke, and that I like how that came out. So that I guess will be out in a couple weeks. And also, Fighting Spirit lately has been featuring a lot more of photos Pete either took or owns the rights to in various articles, and it's been fun to see those too. So everyone, yeah, check out Fighting Spirit magazine.
And as a matter of fact, I believe in that Bockwinkel article, they were asking me for pictures of all those guys. So it may be accompanying it as well.
Awesome. And yeah, everything else, you know, follow me on Twitter at David Bix. You know, check out everything else there. Oh, I will plug 605, though, that me and Brian Last, I think we did our third episode this week talking about the tale of Vince Russo, Skull Von Crush / Vito LaGrasso, and the Mat Rat at Brian's Bar Mitzvah, where they were the main entertainment. Well, not the main entertainment, because there was a DJ and stuff too, but we tell the whole story of that. And of course, you can check that out at 605pod.com. And this week, we're planning on something, I'm sure, that everyone will enjoy, but we're not going to say what it is in advance. So just everyone be on the lookout for that Thursday.
And I know who it is, so definitely be on the lookout for it, because it should be a very entertaining show, but that way, because, this guest will hold nothing back.
Who said it was who?
I said it was a guest.
I didn't say it was a guest.
I said it's a guest. You got a special guest.
If it's a guest, and whatever it is, if it happens to be a guest, and it happens to be someone I know, please say hi.
Okay. All right, I'm going to spoil it. Ed Ferrara, everyone. It's Ed Ferrara. coming off that great gig he did with Kevin Sullivan. He's on Bix's 605 podcast. And he's going to give a true rundown, an oral history over the Oklahoma gimmick on the show.
See, if I'd like to hear an oral history of the Slammers Wrestling Federation.
But no, seriously, yeah, the 605 is going to be a good show. A must-listen show, so go check that out. Now, regarding what I got going on...
Yeah, what do you got going on?
Well, let's see here. You know, we got these shows every week and blah, 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 blah. Exile on Bad Street. Don't know when the next one's going to be. I would like to get one done before the part two of the Smoky Mountain series at the beginning of January, so... Maybe something coming down the pike. We'll see how that goes. But other than that, you know, check out my Twitter feed at KRISCELLNER. Oh, we got a lot of Place to Be Nation shows coming up. TLC is.
Well, that's already going to be up.
It's already up. Yes, yeah, up. That's right. Reaction shows up. NXT TakeOver. Is coming up. So we got that. Ring of Honor, which I don't know if I'm going to be on that one or not, because of it taking place on a Friday, and I'll have to be at work that Saturday morning, so I may not be part of that. But a lot of reaction shows coming up, so definitely check those out. And I'll go ahead and plug the next show, as we will be discussing the week of December the 15th through the 21st of 1995. So a lot
that
of stuff
loaded.
Going on.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff going on that week. Belts going in the trash cans. A couple Ultimate. A lot of the debut of the Ringmaster. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on that week. So definitely look forward to that. And we'll have a suitable guest for the show, or maybe two guests for the show. Who knows? Since we got USC, we'll definitely get that for you the week from today. So on that note, and I got some interesting stuff to talk about off the air, so I can't wait. for Pete, And for Biggs, this is Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
A Monday warrior, mean, mean strike. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean.